Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and light me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. Feel alright. I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you precious contraband and ancient tales.
Oh. Right, all right, all right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And the Monday morning movie reviews are going to begin in just a few minutes here. We got Eric Childress and Steve Procopi. They join me every week to review all the new movies, talk about the box office. We were off last week, so we'll play a little catch-up as well. We were off last week because of the flashback horror convention. So there you go. Today in history, federal prisoners first land at Alcatraz. So we're going to talk about, the essential prison movies. So we're going to jump into prison movies a little bit later on. We're also, we were talking about weird and hilarious snacks that we ate in the 80s, which also got us onto the subject of the fantastic, Burger King / Jack in the Box tacos that Vic and I were so excited about the Jack in the Box tacos that somehow we got into that topic and we were sidetracked talking about Jack in the Box tacos for a good few minutes. So we're going to jump back into those weird snacks and all the other cool stuff that we're going to be doing this morning. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And there you go. We're here till 5. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And let's say hello to my producer, Tom Hush. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Nick.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
All right. Did you have a good weekend?
Yeah, I did. It was nice. I got a surprise sort of visit with the family.
Okay.
Really nice. Went over to my grandma's house over on the northwest side. Had a little Dino's pizza, hung out, talked about all the stuff, and it was great.
All right. Well, cool. Good. It's a good weekend then.
Yeah, not too bad.
All right. And Vic Vaughn is in the newsroom. Hi, Vic.
Good morning, sir.
How are you, buddy?
Pretty good. Not too bad.
How was your weekend?
It went too fast. It's just one of those weekends that just felt like it just boom, gone.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I guess it did go by pretty quick. But yeah, I just, you know, did the typical stuff that I usually do on the weekends, and I ended up, man, it was fun to watch Svengoolie on Saturday. He showed House of Wax, which is just, you know, such a great movie with Vincent Price. That's I love it. So that was fun, and went to go see a couple of movies over the weekend, which we will review in just a few minutes. And so there you go. What's going on for your next weekend, Vic? You guys did not watch Suspiria, I understand.
No. We did have our 13-year-old with us this weekend, so we couldn't watch it in the living room. I talked with Jeannie last night, tried to get her to go in with me, but she wasn't having it. So I said, well, should I give it back to Nick? Should I watch it on my own, which I really don't want to do?
Uh-huh.
And she said, no, we'll watch it this weekend. So
okay,
if you'll let me have it a couple more
days. No. Like I said to you, I have two more copies of it at home.
I don't really want to watch it by myself.
I have three different copies of Suspiria because they kept re-releasing it with more extras and bonus stuff, and so I can't not have all the updated Suspiria copies.
It's in a safe place.
I'm sure it is. I'm just curious to see what you think of it. That's
totally
all.
Yeah.
Because it's a pretty insane movie. And again, remember, it doesn't make a lick of sense. I just want you to know that. The dubbing of the English language, not so great.
I know.
But it is a terrifying and weird movie that is just completely over the top and crazy. And I know that I know, Tom, I know you're a fan.
Yeah, big fan. I'm very curious to see how Vic feels about peacocks afterward.
Okay.
I'm very curious.
Yeah. It was weird because last year at this time, I was cursing the possibility of this remake because they remade it last year, Vic. They remade Suspiria.
Did they?
Yeah. Although,
in the U.S.?
Actually, the Italian director, the guy who directed Call Me By Your Name. Directed. It's one of and Suspiria is one of his favorite movies. Okay. You know, I mean, the guy's from Italy, and he is a big admirer of the director, who is a guy named Dario Argento. And I went in with like the lowest expectations possible. I was cursing it, and I loved the remake.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay, although it's a completely different. It's not really a remake. It's just they take the same plot. Susie Banyan, American girl, goes to Germany and studies at a school of dance. It's run by witches. That's it. That's the plot. And everything that happens in Suspiria, the original Suspiria, they don't recreate in the movie. That would be a big mistake. But I thought it was great, and it's like an hour longer than the original one.
Yeah, but I have to ask, is it as scary as the first?
No, in a different way.
Okay.
But it's great. I mean, the last 20 minutes is completely bat crap crazy. No, I really liked it. It was the biggest surprise of last year.
I would place a wager on this that she's going to want to turn it off within the first 15 minutes.
The first 10 minutes.
We'll
I told you about the first 10 minutes. Don't say I didn't warn you.
I know.
Okay. All right. Well, Vic, we'll get a review of that next week. Vic is here in the newsroom. Tom is producing. I'm here. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, Eric and Steve will be here with our weekly Monday morning movie reviews right here on WGN. Everybody, Nick DiGilio here. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, and we're here till 5 a.m. It is Monday, and again, that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're here till 5. Steve Grzanich comes up at 5 with the opening bell, followed by the great Steve Cochran at 6. Today in history, federal prisoners first land at Alcatraz. We're going to talk about that and then bust into the essential and best prison movies of all time. There are a lot of great ones. We were also last Friday morning. We were talking about weird and crazy snacks that we used to eat in the 80s, and I want to get back to that. We didn't go through the whole thing, and that was a lot of fun to talk about those. So we're going to get to that as well. But it is Monday, and that means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews every week. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me to talk movie reviews, and we'll review all the movies. And then Eric sticks around because he writes a box office report every week, and we will we'll be talking about the numbers for the box office this weekend as well. That's all coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And all right, let's get the guys on. Here is Eric. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
All right, and here is Steve. Hey, Steve.
Hello.
All right, well, I was off last Monday because Steve and I, we were at the Flashback weekend
convention. We were a little busy.
Yeah, it was a little busy. It was great, though, man. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, it was terrific.
Yeah, really great. Nice turnout for everybody. And, you know, very, very cool, very, very cool stars showing up. And we had lots of fun, and I spent some money. I bought a John Carpenter hoodie.
With the names of the movies on the sleeves.
On the sleeves. Yeah. It's a badass. Best $50 I ever spent.
All the movies?
Not all of them.
Oh.
Which ones were you looking?
No, I'm just wondering if you're going to have a John Carpenter, it's like a complete filmography of John Carpenter's work.
Yeah, it's not all of them, but it's
so, so selective.
It's a good one there.
They're all good.
Okay,
but the sleeves are about. I don't have it with me right here, but I think there's like 8 titles on each sleeve or something like that. 7 or 8
is it
titles.
Like End of They Live or
They Live is there. They Live is on there.
In the Mouth of Madness.
In the Mouth of Madness is on there.
Okay.
Yeah. The Ward, oddly enough, not on there.
Well,
I like that movie. I don't care.
I know. It's not terrible.
Yeah. Well, it's also good. So, okay. But then there's like this great montage of pictures on the back that's shaped like his head. And then on the front,
sure.
In the front, there's a Michael Myers is on the front, and it just says, it's a quote from Carpenter that says, horror films will live forever, John Carpenter.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm digging that. And so anyway, but it was fun. Steve, we kept busy all weekend. And
good grief, did we? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and there were lots of people there, and it was you know, as busy as it normally is, but lots of fun. And, of course, my favorite part of the weekend, though, was the Svengoolie thing. The 40th anniversary of Svengoolie celebration, which was just fantastic. And
yeah.
Rich being there for two nights, and then we had a big party for him at the VIP party with a cake shaped like his head.
Yeah.
Which was fantastic. So it was a fun weekend. But we missed last week. And I did not, and Eric, I understand that you didn't see Hobbs and Nobbs either.
Hobbs and Nobbs, no,
yeah.
I did not.
But Steve, you saw Hobbs and Shaw.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's play a little catch up here.
Am I the only one that saw it?
Yeah, I didn't see it.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Okay.
And it's unusual. By the way, it's unusual for me not to see a Fast and Furious movie because I happen to be fans of that series. So
yeah, and I'm not. So yeah.
Okay.
It evens out.
What do you got there, Steve? What do you think?
So it's no secret that the Fast and Furious films, and I think there have been 8 up to this point, get sort of bigger and dumber as the numbers get higher. And but apparently there are so many cast members now that they have to start spinning off characters into their own movies, and the first of these is Hobbs and Shaw. This one follows arguably the two biggest actors in the franchise, and yes, I'm including Vin Diesel, both of whom were sort of latecomers to the series, who were sort of brought in to add a little star power and a little shock and awe to the series. In the case of both of them, I believe they were introduced as characters who were adversaries at first, and then they sort of had to eventually pair up with Vin Diesel's family, in quotes, to fight an even greater threat, whoever that might be. So, you know, Hobbs and Shaw seem to hate each other with a particular flair, so it only makes sense that they get a spinoff where they're forced to work together again and save the world. Hobbs is recruited by the CIA to track down a supposedly rogue MI6 agent named Hattie, who's played by Vanessa Kirby. I didn't even say the two characters, Hobbs and Shaw, played by Dwayne Johnson and Jason Statham, of course, for those of you living under a rock. So apparently this Hattie character has reportedly killed every member of her team that was sent in to recover a deadly virus that kills a person in a matter of a few days. And why would anyone invent a virus like that? I don't know. But then ends up stealing the virus and injecting these sort of microscopic capsules into her own body in order to get away with it. In truth, Hattie has actually injected herself to keep the virus away from a cyber genetically enhanced bad guy named Brixton, who's played by Idris Elba, who declares himself the Black Superman because he's basically indestructible, and he's almost like the $6 billion man, so he's a lot of computers in him and enhancements. What we eventually find out is that Hattie is actually Shaw's estranged sister, and Brixton is a former spy who worked closely with Shaw until he attempted to turn him, at which place Shaw plugged him with enough bullets that he thought would kill him, and he was obviously wrong. There's like a 72-hour time limit, basically, with this virus that seems like a completely arbitrary number designed to give no other purpose than to give the movie a countdown clock. But eventually, Hattie's body is going to, all the organs are going to dissolve in her body, and she'll basically become a virus bomb contaminating potentially millions. So Hobbs and Shaw kind of come together, not knowingly at first, and of course they fight. And the cool thing about Kirby's character is that she, you know, kicks as much ass as her male counterparts by also kind of calling out these two knuckleheads on their posturing and their inability to sort of put humanity before their petty beef. So eventually, when everyone gets that out of their system, they become a pretty interesting threesome, and the Shaws have a slightly more refined approach, and Hobbs basically just punches first and asks questions later.
So the film is directed by David Leitch, the former stuntman and stunt coordinator who made Atomic Blonde. He made Deadpool 2. And I think Hobbs and Shaw kind of shares some qualities, both good and bad, with those movies, which is that when the film focuses on the action, it's kind of unstoppable. When it's just about, like, zingers and dumb jokes and posturing, it gets really boring and old really fast. And, you know, if all you want is to hear The Rock and The Transporter fight over whose faces look more like a scrotum, then you're probably in for the ride of your life. But, you know, like, hear these jokes. And honestly, some of the jokes do hit a little harder, and it feels like a little bit of a roast. And those jokes are a little meaner, and they're really funny, but that's there's not enough of those. So the bigger problem I had is that a lot of the action sequences also look really CGI created and really fake. And I think it's weird that in this franchise where, you know, I realize they've been doing CGI car chases for a while, but to a certain degree they've also kind of held fast to the idea, use practical effects whenever they can. And this film kind of abandons that almost entirely, except for kind of a cool sequence at the end when Brixton's forces are kind of fighting an army of Samoans, most of whom are Hobbs' extended family members, and who are fighting with, like, spears and clubs and other more traditional weapons. And there's a sequence where there are, like, five cars linked together to keep a helicopter from, like, taking off. And I'm sure it is fake, but it looks real and it looks sort of homegrown. And I love that sequence. It's pretty great. But beyond that, there are a few surprises, including some really weird, extended, kind of jarring cameos by some pretty big actors. And also some of the most unnecessary mid and post-credit sequences in the history of this franchise. You know, there's car chases, motorcycle chases, a whole lot of explosions, and some interesting supporting work by people like Eddie Marsden and Cliff Curtis, and of course, Helen Mirren as the Shaw matriarch, still in jail. And but it's a passable placeholder, I guess, till next year's official ninth Fast and Furious movie, but... I don't think I'd revisit this one. There's a certain energy to it that I dug, but it doesn't. I don't know. It's not the same as the main franchise. The dynamic between the characters is different, obviously. And I honestly, unless these guys grow up just a little bit more the next time around, assuming they do another one, I'm probably going to lose interest in this series pretty quickly.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. Hobbs and Shaw. Number one at the box office again. We'll get to the numbers a little bit later on, but that's out right now. We were off last week, so we missed reviewing it. Nothing else really opened last week, right? That was the only...
That was the big wide release.
The big one, yeah.
There's a few independent things open, but that was the big one.
Okay. And it's doing... How is it... I mean, in terms of box office, is it doing as well as the other Fast and Furious movies? Or?
Not really. No, not at all, actually. I mean, it looks like it's probably going to be probably more in line with actually the fourth Fast and Furious movie, which is only about $150 million. It's made about $330-something worldwide right now, but, yeah. Like, the last, like, all the, didn't, all the Diesel, once Diesel came back to the series and Walker and they cleared them up again, like, they haven't had one that's grossed less than, like, $600 million.
Which
is insane just thinking about that.
Yeah.
But this one with the two bigger stars, you know, about Diesel says is probably having a pretty good laugh right now.
Yeah, probably. Probably. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Steve are here. They review the movies with me, Monday morning movie reviews. We had to play catch up, but we were off last Monday morning, so we're back. And now we'll review all the new movies, and we'll do box office as well right after we take a break for the news right here on 720 WGN.
Movie evening shooting.
Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. The anniversary of prisoners first landing at Alcatraz is today, so we're going to bust out some of the great prison movies of all time. And our phone lines and text lines are open at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. So where we go. Let's get back to it. It's the Monday Morning Movie Review. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me every week to review the new movies. And we played a little catch-up from last week with Steve telling us about Hobbs and Shaw. But now we got new movies to talk about. Let's bring the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right, Eric, looks like you're the only one that saw The Art of Racing in the Rain.
Yeah.
So let's hear about this one.
Okay. Well, this movie it stars Kevin Costner, or more appropriately, the voice of Kevin Costner, as we hear him as the voice of Enzo the dog. Enzo the dog is snapped up at a very young age by a race car driver played by Milo Ventimiglia, and is basically the story of this guy's life, or more importantly, this dog's life, as he, you know, becomes man, you know, this guy's best friend, and we get to hear every inner thought the dog talks about, and it's a pretty deep thinking dog. He's got the, you know, he gets to watch a lot of TV, and he talks about a Mongolian documentary that he saw that talks about the spiritual afterlife of dogs. There's very deep stuff going on in this dog's head. While also, you know, requisite poop jokes and things like that along the way as we go through this guy's life. The Art of the Racing in the Rain refers to the Milo's character as a race car driver who is sort of an expert of navigating through the raindrops, and this sort of the, and that becomes a metaphor for life, as you will. He meets a young woman played by Amanda Seyfried. They get married. They have a child. All the complications as we go through the entire span of the dog's life. Okay. So when I saw this trailer, I think for the first time, I think in front of Stuber last month, and I sat there watching this thing, and I sat there watching it and thinking, I don't know if I can sit through this movie. Even though I am a sucker for dog movies, and they just, so many of them just instantly just get to my soft spots, I just watching this this trailer going, they're going to kill this dog. this is a studio that brought us Marley and Me, and they're going to kill this dog by the end of the movie. The first scene of the movie is the dog basically on his last legs.
Oh, God.
I almost walked out immediately because I didn't know if I could handle it. I'm like, no, the dog seems to have something to say. I want to hear what the dog's got to say. Okay, so the first part of this movie I actually think isn't too bad. I actually, you know, it does kind of feel like an audiobook that we're listening to, because so much of it is Kevin Costner narrating the thing, and he's got this deep, gravelly voice. This is not like, you know, Harrison Ford in Secret Life of, you know, Pets 2. He's got like these really sort of deep philosophical thoughts and stuff, all, you know, through a dog's perspective. I'm like, okay, well, this is kind of an interesting way to do a movie like this. And I'm kind of down with this. The human characters are not particularly that interesting, but, you know, seeing them through the dog's eyes, maybe we're going to get to a little bit more interesting talks about spirituality and, you know, all these kind of lofty things that we hope might be in the movie. But this movie just kind of slowly devolves into just one tragedy after another, to the point that it just feels like you can't even bear it anymore. You're sitting there and just like, literally nothing good happens in this movie once it sort of gets going. Yes, there is a marriage. Yes, there is a child. Yes, there are brief moments of happiness and stuff, but there's a lot of foreshadowing going on that things, you know, starting with the opening scene, that things are not going to turn out great for some of these characters. And it just, it begins to just feel like this weight is just an anvil, is just being pressed on your chest. And I come to know the difference when a movie is getting inside of, you know, my sort of spiritual inbox and really trying to navigate and pull, you know, earn tears naturally, and something that is only designed as a tear-making machine. And that's what this thing feels like, because at some point the dog, the lofty dog narration kind of gets thrown in the background a little bit, because the tragedy stuff really starts to take hold. And it gets to the point where, like, the third act of the movie is basically the entire season of Big Little Lies Season 2, which is just completely out of left field and completely just unnecessary. And then it's all leading up to everything you think is, you know, is going to happen in the first scene. So, I mean, I'm not really giving any spoilers here, but I just I couldn't believe watching this thing that they couldn't find something more interesting to say with the story. I mean, the talking through the dog's eyes and ears, and, you know, getting up to where, you know, he's just pooping on the floor and, you know, sitting in his own pee and stuff. It's an unpleasant experience, and apparently the book is even more unpleasant because there's even a false rape accusation in the book. This is a movie that I wish I could have liked a lot more than I did. But it's a tear making factory and an insincere one at the best.
Okay, all right. So that's The Art of Racing in the Rain. Okay, I've kind of had it with dog talking dog movies. I think I've reached my limit for these things.
Well, they do more than cats.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Steve. I believe you're the only one that saw Brian Banks.
Yes.
So let's hear about that one.
Speaking of fake rape allegations, far too often significant true life stories kind of get ruined by attempting to dramatize them or make them more cinematic. Certainly the story of NFL player Brian Banks is an important one, and it's important to tell for many reasons, but it's really easy in this version of his story to get lost in sort of self-righteous nobility and almost like I don't know. It's too polished a lot throughout the whole thing, and we're constantly, things are getting underscored by very important writing and acting and speechifying, as played by Aldis Hodge, who was MC Ren and Straight Outta Compton. Banks was a high school football player, a superstar, really, all-star, on the verge of heading to USC and to begin what would likely become a successful run into pro ball. When a fellow student falsely accuses him of rape, his football career is not only derailed, but he lands up in prison or on probation for like a total of about 10 years. In an attempt to get his life back and make it possible for him to even just get a job, let alone get back into football, he contacts the California Innocence Project, which is led by Justin Brooks, who's played here by Greg Kinnear. The group is hesitant to help him because their primary mission is to get innocent prisoners with long sentences, life sentences or death sentences, out of jail. But Banks pleads with them to sort of help him reclaim a life that was sort of callously tossed away by a crippled justice system. And so that begins the long, sort of time-consuming task of clearing his name. Tom Shadyac directed this, who I'm sure many of you know, directed the first Ace Ventura movie, The Nutty Professor, Bruce and Evan Almighty. But lately he's been on sort of this do-gooder trip. And for anyone who saw his documentary, I Am, this is sort of a continuation of that vibe, and that's not a good thing in my eyes. He removes basically every ounce of subtlety from the story, most importantly making absolutely sure, almost from the first frame, that there is never a doubt in our minds that Banks is innocent from the second we meet him. He sort of eliminates that even dramatic possibility that
something may have actually happened in this rape sequence, but he kind of demonizes the woman who accuses him as well as her mother, and because they both got a big payday from the school district because of this event. There are some very bizarre details in his story, which I assume are true, including the fact that his accuser reached out to him on Facebook after he got out of jail, which resulted in getting an actual filmed confession by her admitting that she lied, but somehow that's still inadmissible in court. So there's plenty of room here to get, like, actually outraged by the way the justice system works, at least in California. But outside of some of these more interesting details, the film offers very few surprises or moments of reflection or insight into the legal process. And so it sort of just defeats the whole purpose of the movie. We assume things are going to turn out a certain way for Banks because we're watching a movie about it. So even that dramatic tension is sort of taken out of the equation. Honestly, it's weird watching a movie today where we are basically told from the first frame, do not believe the victim. That's a weird feeling to sit through for like a whole 2-hour movie. Mm-hmm. So, even though, like, again, it's clear, it's never in doubt, it's obviously what happened. Greg Kinnear is here. Greg Kinnear is Greg Kinnear, and that's about it, all that implies. He's clearly supposed to be like the nice guy, but it feels like he's just doing a little bit of coasting here. Brian Banks, the film feels like a sort of worthy, maybe made for cable endeavor, but there's nothing about this big screen telling that makes it seem like something you should spend your money on. So,
okay. All right, there you go. That's Brian Banks. All right, guys, hang on. We got a break here. Eric and Steve are here. And when we come back, we got more movies to review right here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday morning, and that's what we do. It's also Monday morning movie reviews. Let's get back to them. More movies to talk about. We'll also talk about the weekend box office with our buddy Eric. So Eric and Steve are here. Let's welcome them back. Eric, welcome back. And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, guys. All right, Eric, this is, you tell us about, you're the only one that saw it, Light of My Life, which is Casey Affleck's latest film.
Yeah, Casey Affleck's last film.
Oh, wait, hold on,
film,
Steve,
Steve, hold on a second.
Eric, hang on a second. Hold on.
Yeah.
Steve, you saw it?
I did,
okay,
yeah.
Sorry. Well, Eric, you start.
Okay. As I was saying, I think Casey Affleck's last directorial effort is still under Nick Hsu somewhere. The I'm Still Here, the Joaquin Phoenix wannabe rap artist documentary.
It's hard for me to measure hard for me to measure how much I hate that movie.
Yeah, I know.
Oh my God.
I know.
Okay.
And you're not wrong, but this film is a total 180 departure from that film. For one, it is a narrative, not just written and directed by Casey Affleck, but he also stars in the movie. And this is basically a post-apocalyptic drama where Casey Affleck is one of a large handful of survivors, and his young daughter. I think she's like 12, maybe 13 years old in the film, played by Anna Ponyansky. Basically, it's an apocalyptic world where some sort of virus or plague has basically wiped the world clean of women, with the exception of his daughter, who appears to be immune. She was born right at the time that this plague was starting to take effect. So they wander through the through the world, looking for supplies, trying to keep each other alive, telling stories to one another. The film kind of opens with the really sort of brilliant opening scene where Casey Affleck tells the story to his daughter, story about Noah's Ark, and he makes up a lot of details, and it's, you know, it's kind of a geared towards a kid's story, but it's this sort of remarkable moment where he says that the story is going to be about a female character and ends up being about a male character. And it really kind of sets the tone for this film, which follows, you know, the apocalyptic template, if you will. The things that happen to them along the way are not completely out of place from other apocalyptic movies that we've seen. But he does have to pass off his young daughter as a boy to prevent her from any potential harm or anyone possibly looking to repopulate. So there's a lot of tension there as well. And I think that this is a pretty solid piece of work from him. I think that when this movie just kind of popped up on the radar, seemingly just a few weeks ago, I didn't even know it was coming out this soon. And there was some blowback because people who know Casey Affleck, speaking of I'm Still Here, had some issues, some accusations on the set of that film. And it's, some people thought it might cost them the Oscar for Manchester by the Sea. It didn't. But these sort of accusations have sort of plagued him, whatnot, sort of, no pun intended. And the thought of him doing a movie where some virus has wiped out women from the world, whether this is going to be his sort of either revenge fantasy or his sort of apology tour. And I don't think, this movie certainly doesn't go to the former. And I think it's kind of unfair to even look at it as, the latter, because this is a pretty thoughtful, piece of work. I think he's very good in the film. The young girl is also quite good. Like I said, there's a pretty solid amount of tension throughout the film, and mostly it's just the two of them together and the way that they talk to each other and the way that they tell these stories, and he's trying to be the best dad possible. I should also mention that there's actually flashbacks to just before the plague, and his wife is played by Elizabeth Moss in the flashback scenes. And so this movie is kind of it's sort of like The Road meets Children of Men. I think it's much better than the former, not quite up to the standards of the latter. But Affleck's work here is very strong, both in front and behind the camera. I think it's a pretty worthy piece of work, and it's playing with facets right now. I got to see it on a screener, but I think that if people have the opportunity to see it on a big screen of facets, they should take the opportunity. I like the movie.
Okay, that's Light of My Life, which is at facets right now. Hmm. All right, let's start off with Steve. Why don't you tell us? And I didn't see Dora.
Wait. Do you want me to talk about that?
Oh, wait, Steve, I'm sorry. I forgot. Because on my cheat sheet, it's just Eric's name. So, Steve, go ahead. Okay. Light of My Life. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to add that, I liked it quite a bit, actually. And I was a little less concerned going in about the whole wiping out most women from the planet thing, because I think Casey Affleck's a little smarter than that. It's a very conversation-heavy piece. It's sort of an atmospheric thriller. But there are, like, definite undertones of, like, oppression and alienation and exclusion of women that are almost more about when they were all alive than in the current situation that he's living through with his daughter. There's a really great sequence, lengthy and quite moving conversation between the father and daughter about a basic birds and the bees conversation that is sort of funny but also sort of beautiful and necessary and very moving that I liked. The conversation is actually part of my favorite part of the film because it's so unlike what is essentially, I mean, it's a science fiction film technically, but it doesn't really feel like one. But Casey Affleck, let's face it, he's worked with and learned from the best over his career, and I think he's created a film that's very much his own. And he sort of just added, I think with this film at least, he's added sort of another thing that he's very good at. So I'm looking forward to what he's going to do from this point forward as a director.
Okay. All right, so that's Light of My Life, both positive reviews from Steve and Eric. All right, Steve, tell us a little bit about Dora and the Lost City of Gold.
You know you want to know about it.
Oh, come on now.
Okay, I'll tell you why. So, like, 10 or more years ago, I used to babysit for my friend's kids, and so I got, like, healthy doses of Dora the Explorer, the cartoon. And it's a bizarre show. So when I heard that there was going to be a live-action version of this show about this young girl who kind of spends her life exploring for treasure and other sort of hidden curiosities, I was both intrigued and a little shocked at how they were going to handle it, because the way she addresses the camera a lot of times is I don't know how that would translate. She's got this pet monkey. She's got an adversary that's a fox named Swiper who steals everything she tries to get. But I'm like, again, how are you going to turn that into a live action thing? And so what they've done is they sort of aged her up. They put her in high school. They took her out of the jungle. I mean, we see it happen. They took her out of the jungle. We get a little intro piece where we see her as the age she's supposed to be in the cartoon. And it's kind of funny because she's, again, talking to the camera, and her parents are there with her, and they're looking like, who are you talking to? Like, what is going on here? And her parents are played by Michael Pena and Eva Longoria. So she goes to high school, and it's sort of a different kind of adventure for her. She doesn't seem quite as she doesn't seem to care the way some high school kids do about fitting in. She kind of sticks to her guns and is true to herself. And this cousin of hers that she grew up with, named Diego, who's played as an older kid by Jeff Wahlberg, who I think is Mark Wahlberg's nephew, he's a little embarrassed of her now because she's sort of so colorful. And what's sort of interesting about the film is that, and what I didn't know even going into it, was that, and it's a reason I think to sort of give it a second thought, is that it's brought to us by the director and one of the writers of the guys who did the Muppets, who brought the Muppets back to the movies. James Bobbin and Nicholas Stoller are kind of behind this thing, and they have a knowingness about what's weird about Dora, and they address it, and it makes it sort of funny. It's still sort of very kid-friendly Indiana Jones sort of adventures, but I think a lot of it works, and I think, you know, there's stuff here for adults, there's stuff here for kids. It's certainly not next-level action movie or comedy or anything like that, but it gets the job done. And the lead actress, Isabella Moner, who has been in a run of big films, like she was in the older kid in Instant Family. She was in the Sicario sequel. I think she was in the last non-Bumblebee Transformers movie. She's fantastic in this, and just like really knowing and funny and high energy and endearing, and she kind of captures just enough of young Dora's persona to make her recognizable while still sort of showing us the ways that Dora is sort of making adjustments to this new adventure as a teenager. So there's a few, again, cameos thrown in. I know your favorite actor, Nick, Eugenio Derbez, is in this.
God.
As another explorer who sort of helps Dora and her friends look for this lost city of gold, where her parents are. But then there's also, like, the talking fox who steals things is voiced by Benicio del Toro, who sounds like he's having, like, a straight-up ridiculous time playing this insane fox. It's not gonna set any records. It's not gonna, like, be a benchmark in children's entertainment, but it's a nice sort of combination of nostalgia and a little throwback to a more innocent time in certainly Dora's life, so and mine too. So
okay, all right,
a mild recommendation.
Okay, there you go. All right, Eric, we'll hear what you think of it after we break. Okay. All right, Eric Childress and Steve Procopi here reviewing the new movies. When we come back, we'll hear what Eric thought of Dora and the Lost City of Gold right here on 720 WGN.
You can see all the stars as you walk along.
Welcome Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we're here until 5 a.m. The Monday morning movie reviews are happening right now on this Monday morning, and also my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, as we do every Monday morning. Before the break, Steve told us that he kind of liked Dora and the Lost City of Gold, so let's find out what Eric thought of it. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right, Eric, what did you think?
I liked it, too. Yeah, I'm going to double down on a lot of the things that that Steve said, and I don't think I have the quite the healthy dose of Dora experience that Steve has, but I do have nieces and I do have friends with daughters, so I've seen my share of the cartoon over the years. And what I liked so much about this movie is actually the balance that Boban and Stoller bring to it, and by that I mean that, like Steve said, they kind of address they have the character of Dora and her quirks and the things she does talking to the camera and some of the sprightly ridiculous things that she does at times, and they address that without like going like full Brady Bunch movie on it and just making the whole mockery of it. They actually treat her as a very sincere character who's just a bit out of place, and she's a lot smarter than a lot of the kids in the high school, and I also like the fact that it doesn't just turn into this full-on goofy fish-out-of-water thing. It's like they take her from the jungle, they put her in high school for a little bit, but then they bring them right back into the jungle with some friends of theirs. So it becomes more of a fish-out-of-water story for them than for Dora, and they put her right back in her element. And then it's just kind of just a pleasant family adventure. For one that has actually, I would say, an original quicksand scene where I actually learned something about how to deal with quicksand.
Okay. And we'll talk about the box office that it did over the weekend. But it's nice to see that there's, a pretty decent, family adventure movie out there right now, which is pretty cool. All right, Eric, tell us about The Kitchen.
Okay, well, this is actually based on a DC graphic novel, or comic book for people, and it's set in 1978 in Hell's Kitchen. Three wives of three criminals who are involved in the extortion racket, played by Melissa McCarthy, Tiffany Haddish, and Elizabeth Moss. Their husbands are not great people. They put them down, they beat them, they ignore them. It's just sort of like each one gets their own trait. But they go to jail pretty quickly, after trying to pull a robbery for some fast cash to help them out in their standing in the racket however that's explained. So when they go to jail, and the Irish mob, really doesn't take care of them past one payday, they decide to basically pick up where their husbands left off and take the extortion racket and form it for themselves. And they do it pretty quickly in the movie. In 20 minutes in this film, they have already basically taken over the entire Irish mob without anyone seemingly noticing. The movie then sort of traces their rise to power and how power corrupts and all those sorts of things. Okay, so I mentioned this movie is based on a comic book or a graphic novel. And watching this movie and how shabbily it is put together, it's kind of like reading in comic books. You have, there are great comic books, there are great graphic novels that can tell a complete story and do it wonderfully through visuals and through dialogue and all kinds of things. But this one feels like one of these comic books where it just gives you enough of what's going on. It puts a word balloon up here and there, and you just kind of fast forward through it and speed read it to get to the more interesting parts. The problem is that this movie doesn't really have any interesting parts, but it's paced like you're sitting there keeping looking for them. With the exception of Elizabeth Moss and Domhnall Gleeson, who plays one of the racket's hitmen. Aside from those two characters, there's literally not a single interesting character in this entire movie, which is really kind of shocking how, because it has such a great cast, to it. McCarthy and Haddish, are given so little to do. And I think part of the problem is that the director of the movie, Andrea Berloff, doesn't seem to know if she's making a comedy or a drama. There are bits in the movie where it seemed like McCarthy is somewhere in between the put upon housewife that she's played for so long, who then finds her strength and her voice and her mouth, and then trapped between that and her can you ever forgive me character. And it just, there's an unbalance to both her performance and Haddish's performance that is just so, just kind of off-putting. And he's just like, well, which direction? Are we supposed to be laughing at this? Or are we supposed to be terrified? So all those things are going on. And Elizabeth Moss just kind of is the third wheel in all of this. And so her character, who has probably the best semblance of an arc in a movie, is just feels like she's just being shoved aside, and the closure to that whole storyline just feels rushed and unsatisfying. The Domhnall Gleeson character shows up out of nowhere, but at least that's something that happens in this movie, which is just like I said, the whole movie feels like it's on fast forward, trying to get to what is kind of modulating what exactly the tone of this movie is supposed to be. And then it leads up to this, like, Kaiser Soze, like, twist that is then never mentioned again. It's such an odd beast of a movie, and it's boring on top of it. This is really one of the most shockingly worst films of the year. I think with the exception of Men in Black International, it's one of the sloppiest films I have seen all year.
Yeah, it's a mess, man. it's a real mess. And, I like all three, women in this movie, and I think they're all really great, especially, I mean, obviously, I love Elizabeth Moss. Mm-hmm. And she's the best thing in the film, I think.
She is.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, and she's the best thing in... Oh, Steve, you saw it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because I only had Eric's name down on this one.
Maybe
too.
You didn't get the new update.
I guess maybe I didn't. Okay.
I did either. So
I'll finish my review real quick, Stephen.
Yeah.
We'll get you in.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I was real disappointed with this movie. I was really looking forward to it because I really like the lead and I like the idea of a mob movie led by women. I also love the fact I love that time period, especially in New York. And I think they do. I mean, I'll give you this. The production design, the costumes are great. They did a really nice job dirtying up Hell's Kitchen and making it look like 70s New York. Not quite as good as The Deuce on HBO. But
No, I thought of that movie, that show, the entire time.
Well, as soon as they were in Times Square and she was walking across the street and all the marquees and the hookers, and I'm like, yeah, this isn't as good as The Deuce.
Right.
But there's really nothing here. I didn't care about anything. I think maybe Elizabeth Moss is the only character that I had any kind of like for, and I liked her love interest in it. I thought that's the most interesting angle of the movie, and the only time it ever like really pops off the screen with any kind of emotion at all. It's really poorly assembled movie. Like, it hops around all over the place, and it has no sense of pace whatsoever. Melissa McCarthy, I think going through the motions here, as most people in this movie are. Some things were played for laughs, some things weren't, but there was never a sense of suspense. The whole handling of the husband angle seemed really weird, especially the relationship between Melissa McCarthy and her, the character the actor who played her husband.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's what's supposed to be the emotional core of the movie. And there's supposed to be this like massive sort of payoff, near the end regarding his character that doesn't work. And yeah, the whole here's a surprise twist that nobody saw coming, and it makes no sense. Like I was like, what? Because I was just sitting there going,
yeah,
I don't understand what's happening right now. And you didn't mention Common, who basically basically sits in a car or a van throughout the entire movie.
He's literally the worst police officer I've ever seen.
Yeah, both of the cops and the FBI guys are morons.
Right.
And there's no suspense. And like I said, the only kind of arc that I cared about at all was Elizabeth Moss. And I think 90% of that is because she's Elizabeth Moss.
Yeah.
And that's what she brings to the table, but outside of, like I said, outside of like the production design. The music's good too, like the use of music. But again, this has everything to do with the fact that it takes place in 78 and 79. which are really fun times for music and fun times to look at how crappy New York City was at that time.
But it also seemed like the filmmaker just saw other movies about the 70s and like, oh, those are the songs I'm going to use.
Yeah. No. That's exactly how the whole thing feels. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, oh, we're making a 70s movie. Let's really show everybody that we are making a 70s movie.
Yeah. Here's The Chain. We haven't heard that in any movies recently.
Right. And there's the, you know, like, hey, why didn't you get me Schlitz? You know, there's the big art. She brings home High Life. Why didn't you get me Schlitz? I like Schlitz. I mean, you know, and they're drinking that. They're drinking red wine out of that decanter, which is so 70s. I can't remember the brand, but it's not a clear bottle. It's like a red bottle, and that's what they're drinking the wine out of. And that was like a full on 70s cheap, you know, rot gut wine that people were drinking back then. But I mean, so like the details are kind of fun to watch in the background, but nothing. None of the mob guys are interesting at all. So I don't know. Steve, hang on. Okay. We'll find out what you thought of it right after we break here.
Yep.
Eric and Steve, I didn't like The Kitchen. I was very disappointed in it, and Eric didn't like it. We'll find out what Steve thought of it right after we break. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call and tell a joke. We'll also talk box office, and we'll finish up the movie reviews. Before the break, Eric and I both disliked The Kitchen. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Steve, what'd you think?
I agree mostly. I will say, though, that I didn't find the Elizabeth Moss, Domhnall Gleeson thing interesting just because it was them. I actually found it the only interesting thing in this movie. And I think, like, I would literally have loved to watch a movie about this woman who has spent not just her marriage, but most of her life being abused in one way or another, actually, like, turn the tables and become, like, a full-on assassin after meeting this guy and sort of falling for him, or at least falling for, like, the danger and unpredictability of him. I love that story. And unfortunately, that's not the focus of this movie. It's just one mobster cliche after another. And I found, you know, Eric knows my deep, deep love of all things Margot Martindale. And when you can't use her in an interesting way, especially in a role like this, you've got real issues. And that was sort of my gauge for this movie. I did kind of dig what Bill Camp was doing in this as the Italian mobster who McCarthy kind of teams up with to a certain degree in some racket or another. I think he's manipulating things in a way that I don't even know if she's completely aware of, but I kind of loved his approach to that character. But again, not in it very much, so can't really hang your hook on that. But anyway, it's a bust. It's a total bust.
It is.
Can you guys think of any other movie that is pro-extortion?
Yeah. You know, it's really, I will say this, I've kind of had my limit on watching Elizabeth Moss be abused. I just, because almost every movie she's in.
Yeah, either by someone else or herself.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, her smell, she's abusing herself through the entire movie. All right, well, there you go. Three bad reviews for The Kitchen. All right, Steve, what is Loose?
I did not see Loose.
Okay.
You definitely didn't get my deal because I took that one off.
Okay. What about Eric? You've seen it? Eric?
Yeah, I have seen it.
All right, well, let's hear about it.
Okay, well, this movie premiered at Sundance, and it was so good it played the Chicago Critics Film Festival, which is actually where I saw it. The movie stars Naomi Watts and Tim Roth as a couple of parents who basically become the guardians of who was a child soldier at one time, played by Kelvin Harrison Jr. Obviously is much younger. He's now a teenager and he's in high school. Very smart, confident, very, you know, just sort of the light of their life in a way. He seems to be doing everything right. Octavia Spencer plays a teacher at the high school, who begins to see patterns in him that suggest that his behavior might not be entirely on the up and up. Things that he has said in class, said to her, his sort of thoughts on particular murderous people throughout history and characters in literature and stuff. And so she's a bit concerned and reaches out to the parents to let them know about this. They're not exactly certain that this teacher has their son's best interests at heart, and maybe because of personal things in her life, may also be trying to sort of manipulate the way in her sort of skewed view of history, suggesting that this boy is going to be something that sort of fits in with, again, her view of history more than the path that he has been placed on because of the environment that he now finds himself in. But the movie goes along, it becomes a sort of this dance between mostly the Naomi Watts mother character, Spencer's teacher, and the boys. We sort of follow these characters and how they are trying to pinpoint exactly what this guy is up to. If he's up to anything, is it something a little bit more imagined in Spencer's psyche or not? And it goes to some very really interesting places, really interesting ideas about racism and profiling and things. It's a pretty tense movie, even though it's mostly just a lot of people talking and arguing and just trying to, again, to try to sort of piece together exactly who is on the up and up amongst all these characters, and how far someone is willing to go to protect their child.
All right, there you go. That's Loose, and it's playing at a few theaters here in the city and around, so make sure you check it out. All right, Steve, tell us about Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Gladly. Before you get completely bent out of the shape about the fact that this latest horror offering from producer, and he's also given a screen story credit, Guillermo del Toro, is rated PG-13, take into consideration that the original Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark book series, which was three books over about 10 years beginning in 1981, I believe. The series was made for kids, sort of an entry level into horror. Not in the same way that sort of Goosebumps was. It was a little more advanced than that, and certainly with the artwork that was in it, even more so. But also keep in mind that there have been some very scary and effective PG-13 horror films over the years, including A Quiet Place from last year, for example.
Yeah.
So many examples. The series of books was written by the late Alvin Schwartz, and it was sort of a play off the act of presenting terrifying tales in a group setting. The books were meant to be read out loud, and the book even had suggestions for the reader, the person actually doing the reading, of like scary things they could do while they were reading it to freak out the people they were reading to. So rather than bring sort of the individual stories of those books into sort of an anthology work, the filmmakers have made the stories themselves be the sort of bringer of menace and even death in this story set in 1968 at the height of both the Vietnam War and then also the brink of Richard Nixon being reelected. And it's not a coincidence at all that horror is being presented on two fronts in this film, one in the supernatural world and then one in the political world, specifically the threat of being drafted into the military is a thing that comes up over and over again here. These three small-town teenage best friends decide to celebrate Halloween in various ways, including by hitting the local scary house, haunted house, where the legend has it that a young woman named Sarah Bellows died, maybe at her own hand, and she may still haunt the place. When they're in the house, the kids find a sort of secret room where Sarah's parents locked her away. And in there, they discover a book of these handwritten stories by Sarah, each one featuring very disgusting stories in a lot of cases, with the names of her family members mentioned as the victims of these horrible, presumably fictional scenarios, although it turns out all those people actually did die in horrible ways in real life. So they take the book with them, and before long, new stories start appearing on the pages in fresh red ink that might be blood, and even worse, as they're being written into the book by this sort of invisible hand, the events that are being described begin to happen in real life to people that these kids know. These stories have weird titles like Harold and the Big Toe and the red spot, and the kids sort of have to figure out why it's happening and what they could do to stop it before anyone in their little circle of friends becomes the next victim. So there's a mystery around Sarah Bella's life and death. And that sort of factors into the way they have to stop this from happening. Each of the stories features a really grotesque creature of some sort, the designs of which seem definitely to have been taken from the books and the original artwork by Stephen Gammell, which was later replaced because some people thought the artwork was too intense. But watching these sort of hideous things move and make all these disgusting noises as they sort of jerk and twist around in inhuman ways sort of pushes certain boundaries in this supposedly kid-friendly movie. The director is a great Norwegian director named Andre Overdahl, who did a couple really great movies that I loved. One was Troll Hunter a few years ago, and then more recently, The Autopsy of Jane Doe, which is one of the scariest things I've seen.
I love both of those movies.
They're great.
Troll Hunter is great, and The Autopsy of Jane Doe is terrifying.
Yeah,
I watched that at like 2 o'clock in the morning on my couch alone in my apartment, and I had to turn lights on. It was freaking me out. Okay,
well,
guys.
You have no one to blame but yourself.
Exactly. Okay, hang on a second, okay, guys?
Yeah.
All right, we'll find out what Steve thought of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, what Eric thought, and I'll tell you what I thought of it right after we take a break here on 720 WEGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Lots of movies to talk about this morning, so we're continuing to do that. We'll also do some box office. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're talking about prison movies, too, and more right here on WGN. Before the break, Steve was telling us about Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, the latest movie. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, so continue, Steve.
Yeah, I was just going to wrap it up and say this director has a lot of talent in many realms, but in particular with this film of sort of keeping things just on the right side of graphic and terrifying. That being said, there's one particular monster that's made up of like body parts that separate and come back together and not always in the right way, and the result is like genuinely upsetting sometimes. So, but it's also really fun, and there's a ghastly scarecrow and a severed toe in some food, and the end result of a sort of fairly nasty spider bite. It's just like it's fantastic, and each one gives us just enough to sort of quicken our pulse in a way that feels more like a thrill ride than a kind of endurance challenge where the filmmakers are just sort of testing the limits of blood and guts and taste. So I'm not sure how scared I was by Scary Stories, but I was really impressed with the craftsmanship of both the creature design and the performances by the young cast, and certainly just the period stuff. I wouldn't call Scary Stories a message film, but I also liked that it wasn't afraid to be a little political and features these threads that sort of bring the supernatural in line with the all-too horrors of things like war and Richard Nixon. So despite its slant toward a slightly younger audience, the movie doesn't pander. It doesn't ever feel watered down. It just opts not to get really extreme, and that's fine. Like, we've got plenty of other horror movies this year that will get very extreme, and I'm looking at you, It Chapter 2. But, but as a solid, just like creep show, and especially one that could be like an entry level thing for younger people who might trend darker at a certain age, I think they're going to get a big kick out of it.
Okay. All right, Eric, what did you think?
Ultimately, I liked it too. I'm a bit more of a softer recommendation on the film, as I was for most of the way I was kind of a middle of the road watching the film. I think the movie has a really solid setup with the characters. It had the kind of autumn like feel. The movie, since the movie set around Halloween, that sort of reminded me a bit of Something Wicked This Way Comes, which I think a movie that I absolutely adore. So I think the setup is great, and I think when it gets into sort of the trying to tell all the different stories. For one, it certainly leans into the body horror aspect, which is something that I definitely was not expecting. You know, and there are parts of those sequences that I like and others that I think are not as greatly tied in. I couldn't figure out while I was watching the movie whether or not it would have been better to play it as an anthology thing, but we all know how anthology movies can tend to have its ups and downs and end up ultimately being unsatisfying. So I didn't mind the way that they were doing it. I just thought that since once they sort of get in the middle act of the movie, I think kind of has that anthology sag a little bit because it doesn't have a whole lot of time to build into the suspense of each particular story that is being written about all these different characters, although the payoff of the Scarecrow thing really almost made me gag in the theater. That really sort of affected me. The red dot thing, you kind of see where the punchline of these things going, with the exception of the hospital sequence, which I think is really quite terrific, what ultimately happens to that character, who unfortunately might as well have been played by Eugenio Debez, because I think that Chuck character is so annoying throughout the movie that every time he said something stupid or goofy or was scared, I was just like, oh, I really hope he goes next. But then I think it kind of picks up again during the final act of the movie, which I think is very nicely done. The creature that Steve mentions that appears in that, the design, the sound design particularly, I think is really strong. And I kind of just, thinking back when I was walking out of theater, just there were enough effective sequences in the movie and moments that it'd be just kind of disingenuous to not give it some kind of recommendation to people. I think that it's problematic in the middle. I think the script is not particularly good, but I think it's very well directed. A director that I'm not as fond of as you guys are. I think I like the first hour, two-thirds of Autopsy of Jane Doe, and I think it gets very routine in the third act. And I thought this pretty much the same with Troll Hunter, too, although maybe a little bit less so. But this, I think, is the best thing he's done to date. And, it's not a huge recommendation, but I think it tries a lot harder than a lot of horror films of this type have recently. So I am giving it a recommendation.
I loved it. I loved it. I thought it was great. And, there are times because, I'm a horror fanatic. And I sometimes, especially in the mid-2000s, when all of the Japanese PG-13 remakes, were coming out, there was this whole stigma of a PG-13 horror movie that made me kind of crazy. But that's not even the case. This movie's creepy, man. I mean, it earns. I mean, that spider scene is ridiculous, man. And it made me think of The Believers. You guys remember The Believers?
Oh, with, yeah.
Martin Sheen. First thing. That was a hard R, that movie. But no, I was with this thing all the way through, man. And I want to mention the kids in the movie. I think the kids are great, especially the lead. Is Zoe Margaret Coletti. She's fantastic in this movie and carries the final third pretty much all on her own. It's a very sort of an exhausting performance, and she's really funny and really sweet. And I like the chemistry between her and Michael Garza, who plays Ramon. And I like the other two kids. I didn't find the kid who played Chuck annoying. I liked their relationship, the Augie Chuck relationship. Genuinely creepy stuff. The toe stuff got me. All of that stuff.
That sequence good too.
Yeah. Oh, it's terrific. I'm never going to eat beef stew again. I know that much. But yeah, and all the creatures are really wonderful. That hospital sequence that you were talking about, that creature, I don't know why. It was so creepy, but he's got that smile on his face, or if it's a male, I don't know. But I love the design. And you can see Del Toro's touch on those, especially that last creature, the twisty creature. But it's really scary stuff, and it doesn't hold back just being PG-13. I was surprised at how I love the fact that the kids went to go see Night of the Living Dead at the drive-in. That was that was something that I enjoyed, and I just thought that it was very creative, really creepy. And I'm not familiar with the books because I was a little bit older, for they weren't aimed at my. So I'm not familiar with the books. I don't know if it's faithful. All I know is that it's creepy and that the kids were good and the creatures were great and it was scary and suspenseful and I dug it. I thought it was really, really good. Scary stories to tell in the dark. I'm highly recommending it. I think it's a terrific movie. So there you go. All right, next week, what do we got next week? We got Good Boys.
Good Boys.
And?
Angry Birds Movie 2.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well,
and we actually have the new Richard Linklater film that nobody's seen.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Bernadette, where'd you go?
And a shark sequel.
Oh, yeah. 47 meters down with no cage or whatever the hell.
Uncaged.
Downer.
Yeah. Uncaged. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you, Byron Allen.
Did you say Further Downer?
Yeah. Further Downer? Is that what that's called?
I think it's a better title.
I think so, too. All right. Steve, we will talk to you next week. Thanks, buddy.
Yes. Thanks.
Okay. All right, Eric, let's jump into the box office here.
All right.
Fast and Furious presents Hobbs and Nobbs, Hobbs and Shaw.
Yeah.
25.4 million, 108 million domestically, and you're saying that's underperforming compared to the other Fast Furious movies.
Yeah, totally compared to the other Fast and Furious movies. I mean, but you know, people should point out that Furious 7 and The Fate of the Furious, like, these are two of the highest grossing films of all time, as ridiculous as that sounds. Furious 7 is like top 10 globally, and Fate of the Furious is like 17th.
Crazy.
They're both billion-dollar movies. So, but I think that, you know, it's less that, you know, I joked earlier that Vin Diesel's probably having a good laugh, but I don't think anyone goes to these movies because of Vin Diesel.
Yeah.
So I think that these movies are starting to wane a little bit on the public.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
I mean, look, you know, I haven't even seen it yet because I was busy over the weekend, and I like all of them, or most of them. I didn't like the last one very much. But I'm, you know, I look forward to the Fast and Furious movies, and I still have not gone out. So I think that might say something, you know. Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, 20.8 million. That's solid.
It's pretty good. Yeah, it's pretty good. So we'll just see if it has the kind of word of mouth that needs to sort of keep it afloat.
Yeah.
But it could be looking at like a $50 million gross. Could be more if the word of mouth hits.
Yeah. It was packed when we went Saturday.
Yeah.
And by the way, my folks loved it. My dad loved it. and they both hated The Kitchen. Number three, The Lion King, 20 million. That's up to 473 million just in America.
Yeah, insane. Just
crazy, man. Number four, Dora and the Lost City of Gold, 17 million. Was that as expected?
Not a great number.
Yeah.
For it. It's kind of on par with actually what Spy Kids 2 did many years ago.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that was 2002. That ended up making like 85 million. This one, you know, again, it's going to need some word of mouth to turn a profit for Paramount.
Okay. Number five, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, 11.6 million, over 100 million. How is this in terms of Tarantino dollars?
Very well.
Yeah.
It's doing very well. Another $100 million film for Tarantino. It's only the second original film of 2019 to gross over $100 million.
What's the first?
Us.
Oh, okay. So original meaning?
No remake, no comic book adaptation, no sequel, that kind of stuff.
Okay. All right. I think we need more of those.
Yeah.
Number six, The Art of Racing in the Rain, 8.1 million. That's, you know, considering how popular the book is, that's not good money. That's not good numbers.
No, not really. I don't imagine word of mouth is going to pick up on that one either.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, The Kitchen. Wow. 5.5 million. And the theater was pretty much empty when we went.
Yeah, this is the low. I mean, Happy Time Murders open higher.
Oh!
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Number eight. There we go. Spider-Man's still in there. Spider-Man Far From Home, 5.3 million.
Approaching $1.1 billion.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow. So I'm assuming that did better than the Raimi films, right?
It's the first Spider-Man film to hit $1 billion.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So we've got more movies to review next week. We'll do the box office as well. So I want to thank Eric and I want to thank Steve. We're going to take a break right here on 720 WGN with more after this. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich coming up with the opening bell at 5 and Steve Cochran at 6. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All righty then. So that, of course, was a little Tin Lizzy with Jailbreak. And we are going to be talking about essential prison movies. There have been a lot of prison movies. It's a very, very popular genre. But the reason why we're bringing this up is because on this date in 1934, federal prisoners landed on Alcatraz. Have you ever visited Alcatraz?
No, I've always wanted to.
It's very cool.
Yeah, it seems so mysterious, and I've never even been to San Francisco, so it seems like a good excuse to get over there and just kind of check it out. I hear like there's some haunted stuff going on.
Yeah, no, it's really cool. San Francisco is a lovely city.
Yeah, it seems like it.
It's just it's really, really great. I'm not a fan of L.A.
Yeah, me neither.
But not San Francisco, me. I mean, there's a lot of places in California that are fantastic.
Yeah, the whole Bay Area seems great, and Alcatraz is just a legendary spot.
But it is legendary. In 1934, a group of federal prisoners classified as, quote-unquote, the most dangerous, arrives at Alcatraz Island, a 22-acre rocky outcrop situated 1.5 miles offshore in San Francisco Bay. And they arrived on this date in 1934. The convicts, the first civilian prisoners to be housed in the new high-security penitentiary, joined a few dozen military prisoners left over from the island's days as a U.S. military prison. Alcatraz was an uninhabited seabird haven when it was explored by Spanish Lieutenant Juan Manuel de Ala in 1775. It was fortified by the Spanish. Alcatraz was sold to the United States in 1849. In 1854, it had the distinction of housing the first lighthouse on the coast of California. Oh, wow.
More than just a prison.
Wow. Okay. Beginning in 1859, a U.S. Army detachment was garrisoned there. And from 1868, Alcatraz was used to house military criminals. In addition to U.S. soldiers, prisoners included rebellious Indian scouts, American soldiers fighting in the Philippines who had deserted to the Filipino cause, and Chinese civilians who resisted the U.S. Army during the Boxer Rebellion. In 1907, Alcatraz was designated a Pacific branch of the United States military prison, and in 1934, Alcatraz was fortified into a high-security federal penitentiary designed to hold the most dangerous prisoners in the U.S. penal system, especially those with a penchant for escape attempts. The first shipment of civilian prisoners arrived on August 11th, 1934. Later that month, more shiploads arrived, featuring, among other convicts, infamous mobster Al Capone. And in September, George Machine Gun Kelly, another luminary of the organized crime, landed in Alcatraz. In the 1940s, a famous Alcatraz prisoner was Richard Stroud, the Birdman of Alcatraz, a convicted murderer. Stroud wrote an important study on birds while being held in solitary confinement in Leavenworth Prison in Kansas, regarded as extremely dangerous because of his 1916 murder of a guard at Leavenworth. He was transferred to Alcatraz in 1942. Stroud was not allowed to continue his research at Alcatraz. Although some three dozen attempted, no prisoner has known to have escaped successfully from the rock. However, the bodies of several escapees believed drowned in the treacherous waters of San Francisco Bay were never found. The story of the 1962 escape of three of these men, Frank Morris and brothers John and Clarence Anglin, inspired the 1979 film Escape from Alcatraz, which, by the way, is a great movie. Clint Eastwood. So
it's Clint.
It's Clint. Yeah. Another prisoner, John Gills, caught a boat ride to the shore in 1945 dressed in an army uniform he had stolen piece by piece, but he was questioned by a suspicious officer after disembarking and sent back to Alcatraz. Only one man, John Paul Scott, was recorded to have reached the mainland by swimming, but he came ashore exhausted and hypothermic, and at the foot of the Golden Gate Bridge, police found him lying unconscious and in a state of shock. In 1963, U.S. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy ordered Alcatraz closed, citing the high expense of its maintenance. In its 29-year run, Alcatraz housed more than 1,500 convicts. In March 1964, a group of Sioux Indians briefly occupied the island, citing an 1868 treaty with the Sioux allowing Indians to claim any unoccupied government land. In November 1969, a group of nearly 100 Indian students and activists began a more prolonged occupation of the island, remaining there when they were forced off by federal marshals in June of 1971. I remember when all of that was happening. I was really, really young. Obviously, I was a little kid, but I do remember that. And it's been documented, too. There's a lot of stories about that time. And in 1972, Alcatraz was opened to the public as part of the newly created Golden Gate National Recreation Area, which is maintained by the National Park Service. More than 1 million tourists visit Alcatraz Island and the former prison annually. So there you go. So, you know, Alcatraz is probably the most notorious prison in America.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Leavenworth was mentioned in there, and maybe Sing Sing.
Yeah,
but really, it's Alcatraz.
It is. I mean, Alcatraz is. It's got the most. you know, it's really sort of got like the coolest backstory about it. Like that whole story is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
That all of that stuff is associated with Alcatraz. It's also just in the middle of the bay, which just makes it really cool.
Yeah.
You know? And I mean, there's just so many sort of, you know, legendary stories that, that, you know, were there. And then of course, you know, they've made movies that take place in Alcatraz, obviously Escape from Alcatraz. There are other, I think, there's another Clint Eastwood movie. There's a Dirty Harry movie that has a sequence that takes, because Dirty Harry movies take place in San Francisco.
Right.
So there's a Dirty Harry movie that has a sequence that takes place in Alcatraz, and then I believe that was before he made Escape from Alcatraz.
Yeah, that was.
Enforcer?
Yes, The Enforcer, yeah. 76.
Yeah, that's a couple of years before he made Escape from Alcatraz.
Yeah, and The Enforcer's a great one too.
Terrific movie. Yep. All the. I even backed the last Dirty Harry movie.
The Deadpool.
I backed that one.
With Jim Carrey singing Guns N' Roses.
Singing Guns N' Roses. The car chase with the little toy car.
That's actually really fun.
I love it, man. I love that movie. I think all of the Dirty Harry movies are good. No, the first one's still by far the best.
Oh, no doubt.
But
didn't the second one have David Soul in it as
David
like
Soul cur- and David Soul and somebody else played murdering cops. Like they were cops.
Yeah,
they were
Magnum Force.
Magnum Force. Yeah, that was the second one.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember who the other Robert Urich. Robert Urich, who would go on to be in Vegas. Yeah. So, all right. Well, anyway, the anniversary here for Alcatraz. And now we're going to talk about some of the most essential prison movies, which is a fun little subgenre. What are your favorites? What are your favorite prison movies of all time? 312-981-7200. We'll talk about that after the news, which is after this.
I ain't spending my life here. I ain't living alone. Ain't breaking no rocks on the chain gang. I'm breaking out and heading home. I'm gonna make a change.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. Monday morning, that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because he does that every Monday morning. We get to hear a joke from my dad. And we'll do that a little bit later on. We are talking about, in honor of the anniversary in 1934, yesterday was the first time federal prisoners were put into Alcatraz, one of the most famous, if not the most famous or infamous prison. So we're talking about prison movies. And what are the essential ones? What are your favorites? 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. So we've got a whole bunch of them that we're going to be talking about. We got some texts coming in already. Mark the Breadman says, my two favorite prison movies are by Stephen King, The Green Mile, and The Shawshank Redemption. Both Frank Darabont-directed movies. 773 area code says, my favorite prison movie is Canned Heat. And 630 area code says, hey, Nick, wasn't The Rock with Sean Connery based on Alcatraz Island? Yes, indeed it was. Nicolas Cage, Ed Harris, Sean Connery. One of the only Michael Bay movies that doesn't make me vomit. I can kind of back The Rock. It's a stupid movie, very, very silly, but I think easily the best movie that Michael Bay's ever made. All right, let's see. Here's Paula on WGN. Hi, Paula.
Hi. I'm calling about one of the great actors, Burt Lancaster, very versatile, and he started out with Brute Force, a prison movie,
yeah.
And of course you mentioned Birdman of Alcatraz, so those are two great ones.
Yeah.
And I did also want to just mention, although it wasn't a prison movie, James Caan's direct description of being in prison and what happened to him and how he felt about it in that great scene in Thief,
yeah,
where he's talking. That tells in a few minutes. It's almost a whole prison movie in itself.
Yeah. No, it's a great scene. That's when they're in the diner at the Oasis. They're at one of the suburban Oasis diners. It's him and Tuesday Weld.
Yeah.
It's a great sequence. I mean, a really, yeah, really great sequence.
Yeah. And one last word, because I love Lee Marvin. When he took his walk as Walker in, Point Blank. Right. Remember the sound of his feet walking against the empty prison floors. That was a great moment. Yeah. And yep. I think it was Alcatraz. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I have to go back. I haven't seen that movie in a while, but I love that movie. It's a great movie.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks, Paula.
Good night.
Okay. Yeah. You know, Burt Lancaster, two classic prison movies. Brute Force was from 1947. Burt Lancaster was a great choice in this prison break drama that was directed by Jules Dassin, and who did Rafifi and Naked City. Robert Mitchum, when you you got the likes of Robert Mitchum or Sterling Hayden, you could star in this movie. Here, Lancaster uses the bulk of physically has an imposing presence to dominate the screen while throwing punches and fighting his way out of a bad situation. The film leads up to a shockingly violent, at least for the time, prison riot when the inmates can no longer take Captain Muncie's sadistic tactics, played by an incredible Hume Cronin in this movie. As he holds power over a small kingdom, they decide to put into action their long-plotted escape, which goes off, but you might not be as expected. The cast all around is very good, but it's Lancaster who really makes the material sing, leading the riot to its bloody conclusion. It's a brawny, cynical film in a way that almost prefigures a more modern era of downbeat anti-heroism in film and TV. And then, of course, Birdman of Alcatraz, which we mentioned. He did that one in 1962. The most famous prison in the history of the U.S. is unquestionably Alcatraz, the island fortress off the coast of San Francisco, and its most famous inmate beyond Al Capone was probably Robert Stroud, the subject for John Frankenheimer's Birdman of Alcatraz, in an excellent performance by Burt Lancaster. Stroud, sent to prison at 19, is sentenced to life after killing a guard. But per the screenplay based on Thomas Gaddis's book, it becomes a model of reform. He becomes a model of reform thanks to his interest in ornithology, which saw him become a world-renowned published expert on bird diseases, despite never again leaving jail. The film is admirably liberal in its support of prison rehabilitation and its condemnation of the inhumanity of prison. Carl Malda makes a great villain as the warden, but there's a disingenuousness to the approach of to Stroud, which overlooks the more troubling aspects of his personality in favor of a mild-mannered persona. Even if Lancaster occasionally sprinkles in some edge, Frankenheimer seems a touch wasted on the quieter material, bar a late prison riot that brings some needed energy to the film, but it's still an engaging biopic if you ever overlook the glossed-over nature of the scripting. I like The Birdman of Alcatraz. All right, we're talking prison movies. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. Here's Mark on WGN. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, there's a brief scene in a movie called Face Off where they're in prison, and the prison is called Erewhon, which supposedly is an anagram for nowhere, and the guys are wearing electromagnetic shoes that keep them firmly anchored to the prison floor, and the warden says, listen, guys, I own your butt. Well, he doesn't use the word butt, but anyway, it's not a very long prison scene, but it's where the exchange of persons takes place.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's, of course, a John Woo movie. Nicolas Cage and John Travolta.
The most eerie thing to me about it was the guys being glued to the floor with electromagnetic shoes. That just weirded me out.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Mark. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to join us. Hey, what the hell was the name of that terrible Schwarzenegger-Stallone movie?
Oh, Escape Plan.
Oh, my God.
Did you know there's two sequels to that?
What?
Yeah. Both starring Dave Bautista and Stallone.
Wait.
Yeah.
Stallone is in, they've made two sequels to that? How is that
possible?
Escape
Plan. Yeah, they're like direct to video.
God.
Yeah, and Dave Bautista is in both of them. The most recent one is Escape Plan, The Extractors.
What? Are they still in like the glass booths?
You know, I watched the second one, and it's more or less just the first one again.
Without Schwarzenegger.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, Batista is basically taking Schwarzenegger's place.
Yeah, more or less. And let me see here. I want to say, Escape Plan 3 also has Curtis 50 Cent Jackson, who was in the first one, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
He was in the first one.
Yeah, so he's returned to this series, I guess.
What?
I know. I know.
I didn't realize that the movie had enough attention or box office to worth, you know, to be worth for two more sequels.
I didn't know that Stallone was doing direct-to-video.
Oh, he's done a lot of direct-to-video.
Yeah, I guess. I just always thought that he would never, like,
he's got a lot of direct-to-video titles.
Yeah.
Everybody has been doing those.
That's true.
You know what's really funny is, you know who now basically exclusively just does direct-to-video? John Cusack.
Yeah.
He's got, like, a giant list of straight-to-video. I'm trying to think of the last movie that he did that was a theatrical release.
What was it? The Edgar Allan Poe one?
Ugh.
I think was in theaters, where he's like, he's a detective.
I was so looking forward to that movie because Poe is like my favorite writer, and I love the poster. I remember the poster art.
Yeah, it's a great poster.
Fantastic. And I was like, okay, it took 10 minutes into the movie and I'm like, oh god,
checked out.
Awful movie.
Yeah, awful. There was movie. I just didn't get the premise where it's like, yeah, Edgar Allan Poe, you're going to be a detective now, solving. Yeah. It's like, you know, the murders out of his books come to life or whatever.
It was
like,
terrible.
This is dumb.
It was terrible. Absolutely terrible. There is a movie to be made about Poe that needs to be
made.
Oh,
no doubt. No doubt.
You know, because his story is so crazy. But that wasn't the movie at all. I mean,
no, and John Cusack was not the man to play Poe.
You know what's really funny? I watch, as you know, I've watched Seinfeld forever. And last night, you know, because it's on every night at 10 and 10:30 on the U, which is becoming the CW.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
So what's happening
September 1st, channel 26, or however you have it on your cable. It's channel 8. It's channel 8 on my, no, 183. It's 183 on my cable. Is going to become the new CW.
Really?
And then the U is moving to a different channel.
Interesting.
So the U is still going to exist, but that channel 26 is going to be your Chicago CW.
That'll be the Chicago.
Yeah.
Okay.
They were just advertising it last night when I was watching Seinfeld. But the reason I bring it up is because I always find it hilarious when I look at some of the stuff on Seinfeld's set, you know, like in his apartment in particular.
Right.
You know, like what food he has on the shelf and all that stuff, what's in the fridge. But my favorite little detail, and I don't know why this is, that this was, of course, this was back, you know, in the 90s when it was pre-DVD. You know, DVDs really didn't take off till the late 90s, early 2000s. That's
right.
When I got my DVD player. I got the first DVD player at the beginning of 2000 was the first time I got a DVD player. So,
right.
So at this time on Jerry's shelf are VHS tapes. And I don't know if you ever look at the, because I love to look at the background of some of those things just to see how the sets have been decorated.
Yeah.
For some reason, and this is in multiple episodes. In that, and I want to say it was season 6 or 7, mid-90s, 96, something around that time. For some reason, and I don't know why, you see, you know, other movies, got Child's Play.
Which is a weird choice for Jerry.
Absolutely weird choice for Jerry. He's got other movies that you can spot, but the weirdest thing is he has two copies. Not one, but two copies on his shelf, VHS, of the James Spader, John Cusack political thriller, True Colors.
Smart man.
So for some reason, he's got two copies of True Colors, which is a movie that made about $1 at the box office. Nobody saw it. Nobody even knows it exists. So I guess maybe it's like an inside joke. Let's put two copies of this obscure bomb with James Spader and John Cusack, True Colors. Let's put two copies. And they're like, they're separated by a, because there's a Superman in every episode of... In every episode of Seinfeld, there's a reference to Superman or a picture of Superman somewhere in the background in every episode, in his apartment, all over the place. And it's separated by a little miniature Superman. So you've got...
So you've got True Colors, copy number one.
Yeah.
Little Superman.
True Colors, copy number two. On VHS.
Wow, somebody get that set designer.
It's unbelievable.
Get that guy a big old check.
Yeah. All right, we're gonna break here, and we are talking about... prison movies. What are some great ones? What are your favorites? There's a ton of them, and we want to hear from you at 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for prison movies. Talk or text.
I hear the train a-coming. It's rolling around the bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison. And time keeps dragging on.
That's right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And we are now talking about prison movies. What are your favorites? What are the best ones that stand out in your mind? It's a very, very, very popular subgenre. And it is the anniversary of the first federal prisoners being put into Alcatraz this morning. And so we're talking about prison movies. And we got a bunch of texts that are coming in. If you want to call, the phone lines are open. Text lines are open. Prison movies, 312-981-7200. 804 area code says, I love Papillon. And more recently, the Escape from Siberia movies, Ashes in the Snow, and the one with Saoirse Ronan. The name of the movie escapes me right now. Is that Hannah? Maybe. Is he talking about Hannah?
Could be.
Okay.
There's a lot of people texting in how do you pronounce
Papillon.
It? Papillon.
Yeah. The original, not the remake from last year, which was terrible.
Yeah, that was bad.
It was Rami Malek, and who was the other guy who played the Rami Malek played the Dustin Hoffman role, and then I can't remember who played the it was Hemsworth, I think.
No, it's the guy who looks like he's Charlie Hunnam.
Oh, that guy. Yeah.
Yeah, he's like the Chris Hemsworth alternate.
Yeah. He was in, the first time I remember seeing that guy, he was in this amazing soccer hooligan
Green
movie.
Street Hooligans.
Oh, my God. With Frodo.
Yeah.
I love that movie, man. I love that movie. I think that movie's great. Yeah, that was the first time I remember seeing that.
Yeah,
guy.
That was a really good movie. That was a very interesting, very specific type of movie.
I thought it was great, man.
It's a total subgenre in the UK.
Yeah,
like as much as we have direct to video, just like prison movies or whatever action movies, there's a whole industry of hooligan movies.
Well, that movie got a big release. I remember
it did.
My ex-wife and I saw it in the theater. We both loved it. And then he ended up in the Sons of Anarchy. That was the thing that kind of put him over the top.
Yeah.
Anyway, but the remake of Papillon is not good. The original is fantastic. The original with Steve McQueen and Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah, a lot of fans of Papillon.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a classic. That's one of those great prison, movies. And of course, it's McQueen is in it.
Yeah.
So
Steve McQueen.
Right there. 847 area code says Jailhouse Rock, Elvis rules. I love Jailhouse Rock.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's a great movie.
Chris in Elk Grove says Ernest Goes to Jail, a great prison movie.
How much money do you think Jim Varney made out of being Ernest?
I miss Jim Varney. It's sad. He passed
great.
Away. He passed away, yeah. And I thought he was funny.
All those movies came out when I was a kid, so yeah. I was like, yeah, Ernest Saves Christmas.
I have a friend who legitimately... Like, he's around my age, maybe a year younger than me, so he's in his 50s, and he legitimately loves all the Ernest movies. Like, he loves them. He thinks they're like his favorite movie. Like, those are go-to comedies for him. Like, repeat
wow.
viewing.
Well, you know what? Good for him.
He loves them.
Good for him. Hey there, Vern.
Yeah. He was also in the terrible movie version of the Beverly Hillbillies. It was him and Erica Laniak. A famous Playboy playmate.
Yeah.
She played oh God, I can't even remember the character's name.
Because he was Jed.
Yeah, he was Jed. And it was, who else was in that? Who played Grandma?
Grandma, let me look at this cast here.
Oh, Cloris Leachman.
Yeah, Cloris Leachman as Daisy May, Granny Moses.
Right. And Diedrich Bader.
It was Jethro.
Yeah. Ellie Mae was
Erica.
Erica Eleniak.
Lily Tomlin as Miss Jane Hathaway.
Right, she played the Jane Hathaway role.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Rob Schneider. Ugh.
And I'm trying to remember who the director
directed by Penelope Spheeris.
Penelope Spheeris, that's right.
She had an interesting career
she
in
did.
The 90s. She
yeah,
did some
she
interesting
did.
Stuff.
You know, the thing about Penelope Spheeris is I mean, I don't like Fast Times. I'm like the only person on the planet that doesn't like Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I don't like it. I think Sean Penn's great in it, but I don't like the movie. It just leaves a real bad taste in my mouth. I just don't think it's very funny, especially what they put Jennifer Jason Leigh's character through in that movie. It's just it's not fun. Anyway, I don't know. She's never made a movie. Penelope Spheeris has never ever made a movie as good. And she never will, in my opinion, make a movie as good as Clueless. I mean, I don't know how. I can't believe she directed it because she's directed so many bad, so many bad films.
Well, I love her. I mean, and obviously Clueless, undisputable classic.
Yes,
but I personally love her because of The Decline of Western Civilization.
Sure. Both
of those. Which is totally a different thing.
Yeah. No, but I'll give her that. Yeah.
And then
both of the Decline movies I like.
Yeah.
The Metal Years.
The Metal Years is great.
And the other one. I'm not a Wayne's World guy.
That's my vote for her is that I love Wayne's World.
Yeah. But man, Clueless is just, I mean, that movie is just great. It's just great. Anonymous texted in, Cool Hand Luke is not only a great prison movie, but also one of my all-time favorites. Paul Newman, George Kennedy, and many others playing inmates on the Alabama prison farm. Cool Hand Luke is legendary. You can't talk about prison movies without talking about Cool Hand Luke. You've seen Cool Hand Luke, right?
A million times.
Yeah.
That's like you sit down with your old man and you watch Cool Hand Luke.
And eat some hard-boiled eggs.
Yeah. What we have here is a failure to communicate.
Well, it's Strother Martin, man.
Yeah,
Strother Martin.
What a dude.
It's Chong's dad in Up in Smoke.
Yeah.
You get a job before sundown, or we're shipping you off to military school with the damn Finkelstein crap kid. Son of a bitch. I love, that's one of my favorite scenes in film history. I love the fact that, like, who the hell thought Strother Martin should play Chong's dad? I mean,
a genius, that's
and
who.
He's one scene. He's just in one scene, and it's one of my favorite scenes in film history.
I'd put it up there with casting Rip Torn as
Freddie Got Fingered.
Yeah, Freddie Got Fingered.
Tom Green's dad.
What an inspired choice.
Yeah, but I mean, but at least, like, you know, Rip Torn is in a lot of the movie. Like, Strother Martin's in one scene. He's just in the first, like, he's in a 3-minute scene at the beginning of the movie, and then no more Strother Martin.
I guarantee you they just said, like, hey, you got 2 hours.
Well,
just come on
there,
over.
I have the special edition of Up in Smoke because, you know, I do, because it's Up in Smoke. But there are scenes there that were cut out. Strother Martin.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There were deleted scenes with Strother Martin. All right, we got a break here, and we are talking about prison movies, and Strother Martin, obviously, from Cool Hand Luke. A legendary, quintessential prison film. So that's what we're talking about. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We'll talk more about the prison movies after the news, which is up after this.
Who put us back on the train?
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. It is a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Phone lines are open. Text lines are open. We've been starting to talk here about essential prison movies. There have been a ton of them, and some of them are really great. And that's what we're talking about on this, the anniversary of 1934, when the first federal inmates were put into Alcatraz. So we wanted to jump in on the world of prison movies at 312-981-7200. Some texts here, and then we'll jump back to the story. By the way, the story is from IndieWire.com, where they put together the 25 most essential prison movies. And this is one of the reasons why you should like us on Facebook right now, because you can read the entire article directly on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. So like us right now, facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right. Joe sends in a text that says the coleslaw reduction with Tim Robbins is the best. Does he mean the Shawshank Redemption? Is that what he means?
I think it might be a typo.
Because the coleslaw reduction, that's not a thing. The Shawshank Redemption, however, is. I don't know how you can get coleslaw reduction from Shawshank Redemption. But yes, with Tim Robbins, the Shawshank Redemption, not the coleslaw reduction.
I'd watch that movie.
That's something you can watch on the Food Channel, I think.
How to cut a little coleslaw out of your life.
815 area code says, good evening, guys. The movie goes by two different names, either Cadence or Stockade. It's a military prison in West Germany starring Charlie and Martin Sheen. I saw it as Cadence. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Emilio directed it. Emilio Estevez, I think, directed it. Or somebody, I don't know. But I know that Charlie and Martin Sheen are in it, and I saw it as Cadence.
It's directed by Martin.
Martin Sheen. Oh, his dad.
Yeah, it's directed.
Okay. 708 area code says Bad Boys with Sean Penn. The good Bad Boys, not the terrible Bad Boys. Bad Boys, right, shot right here in Chicago.
Yeah, yeah.
Sean Penn, Ally Sheedy, I believe her first movie. I think it was Ally Sheedy's first movie because it was pre-War Games. That's a really great movie, man. Directed by Rick Rosenthal, who directed Halloween 2. Was hired by Deborah Hill because of a short film that he made. Because Carpenter did not want to do Halloween 2. He co-wrote the screenplay, didn't really care about it.
Yeah, he didn't want to do it.
Didn't want to do it. And so when Halloween 2 made a lot of money, and I love this too, because Halloween 2 is terrible. Halloween 2 is terrible. There's one sequence in it. No, there's two sequences in it that I like. And this is really weird, and I'm not making this up, Tom. When I saw the movie, I was so disappointed by it, you know, because it came out two and a half years after the original Halloween. So my friends and I went first opening night, Friday night, Norwich Theater, a bunch of us, my high school buddies and I go, and I thought it was terrible, except for two scenes. And then I found out later that Carpenter directed those two scenes that I liked. Because he came on the set, because I think he was away doing the thing at the time. Mm-hmm. And so he was finishing up Escape from New York or something along those lines. So he goes to the set to see what's going on because they hire this Rick Rosenthal guy, and he looks at the dailies. He's like, "What the hell is, you know, what is this?" Because there's tons of blood in it, and it was just, you know, it became yet another slasher movie that were so popular at that time, kind of just like forgetting the history of how great a film Halloween is and how subtle a movie it is and how damn scary it is. And there's no blood in Halloween, so people are always like, "Oh, it's so bloody! It was such a bloody movie." It's not. It's just an incredibly intense.
Yeah, I think you get like a cut on Jamie Lee.
She gets a cut.
She gets one little cut.
There's some blood in the opening sequence with the sister where he stabs his sister. And then when Nancy Loomis gets her throat cut in the car, blood hits the window. But that's it.
Yeah, not what I would say. That movie is rated R for like the sexual content.
Language and all that stuff. And it's so intense.
Yeah,
and you know, there's no blood. You know, when he sticks the guy to the wall, when he lifts up the dude and sticks the knife in, no blood.
Yeah,
and then he does the dog, and that's Nick Castle. That was Nick Castle's choice to do the looking at him like a dog, where he tilts his head. It's one of the most memorable moments in the movie.
Yeah,
but anyway, when Halloween 2 came out, these are the two scenes that are good. There's a scene where because he terrorizes the hospital in it, for those people who might not have seen it. There's a scene where he hooks up an intern. It's either a nurse or an intern. It's a nurse. Hooks her up to a blood transfusion tube and leaves it open and bloods her and she bleeds out. And the guy walks in, discovers the body, turns around and slips on the blood and falls back and bangs his head on the ground. And like then he's like completely, he's all loopy after that because he smashed his head on the ground. That the way that that scene is constructed is really good. And the other scene is when Ben Tramer gets hit by the car and the car crashes into another car and explodes. That's the best. And those are the only two good scenes that were in Halloween 2. But yeah, Rick Rosenthal would go on to direct a classic, Bad Boys. Yeah, great, you know, prison movie. Juvie. It was a juvie movie where they were all juvies. There's a part of the movie that I think is pretty inconsistent or kind of weird because they shot the movie here. And Jewel, you know, the wonderful Jewels, they used to have their own like Jewel brand pop that was called Yummy. It was called Yummy, Yummy Pop. And it came in, you know, I remember stocking it because I worked at the Jewels for years. But they had, you know, your ginger ale, your grape, cola, root beer, all of your basic generic pop flavors it came in, and it was Yummy. There's a scene in the movie where he's being hassled by Clancy Brown and a bunch of other inmates, Sean Penn. So he takes a pillowcase, and there's a vending machine inside the juvie hall in Bad Boys. And he gets a pillowcase, and he gets a bunch of cans of Yummy soda from the vending machine and puts them into the pillowcase and then beats the hell out of them with the pillowcase full of cans. It's great. It's brutal. It's fantastic. But here's the thing. Yummy was never in vending machines. Yummy was a Juul brand.
The Juuls.
And so, you know, I guess, you know, the production probably thought, well, nobody's going to know what this is. But Chicagoans were like, wait a minute. You can't get Yummy in a vending machine. You get Yummy a Juul on the shelf, not in a vending machine. So, because all the regular, you know, all the Chicagoans in the audience went, ah, like when he goes to the vending machine and gets out a bunch of Yummy Cola. We're like, you can't get Yummy Cola in a vending machine. This movie is inconsistent. About this one, 847 area code Stir Crazy. That's a prison movie. It's totally a prison movie. It's it's a prison escape movie. It's a prison escape slash rodeo movie.
Love it. Love it.
It's such a strange movie. I remember when Stir Crazy, I mean, it's just the reason why that movie works is because, I mean, it's a pretty stupid movie, but it's Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder. And together, you know, they were so great.
I mean, there's just an amazing
See No
duo.
Evil, Hear No Evil.
Yeah.
Where he's Richard Pryor's blind and Gene Wilder is deaf. Which, of course, is a stupid premise, but somehow they make it work. The only one that was bad was Another You, the last one they did together, because Richard was real sick and very, very frail at that time. And, you know, it's kind of hard to watch because it's But Stir Crazy and Silver Streak, please. So.
Amazing collaborations.
Yeah. All right, let's take a phone call here before we get the weather. Here's Rich on WGN. Hey, Rich.
Hey, Nick. Good morning.
Hi.
Got three I could throw into the hopper. One being An Innocent Man, which Tom Selleck.
Yeah, Tom Selleck.
Mm-hmm. First half of the movie is actually fairly riveting. The second's a little predictable, but the prison environment in that movie and just the sociological. It's pretty good. I think Kevin Bacon was in one with Alcatraz, and I think he was the last prisoner to leave Alcatraz. I think it was called Murder in the First.
Yeah, Murder in the First is that's definitely the one with Kevin Bacon.
Yeah, and then I think this would count as a prison movie. And arguably Sean Connery's favorite personal performance, I think, The Hill.
The Hill.
Yes, yeah, it was made right after he did Goldfinger.
Oh, and, okay.
Yeah, it's with Michael Caine. He played a war prisoner, World War II prisoner, and he was thrown into a prison in the desert. And the prisoners all had to, create this giant hill that they keep on having to run up and down.
Wow, I don't remember this one at all.
It's really good. It's made about, I want to say, 1965, I think, or 66, and he put up a lot of money for it, and it's a real sweaty movie too.
Yeah,
it's very good. I highly recommend it.
All right, I'll check it out. Thanks, Rich.
All right, take care.
The Hill with Sean Connery.
I think my dad talked about that one.
Did he?
That sounded incredibly familiar. For a concept that they just kept making him run up and down this hill as part of his prison sentence.
Mm. All right. 773 area code says, Let's Go to Jail is another dumb movie.
Let's Go to Prison.
Let's Go to Prison. Well, that was Nick from New Girl. Jake.
No, that's Let's Be Cops.
Oh, that's Let's Be Cops.
Let's Go to Prison is Will Arnett and Dax Shepard.
Oh, right.
And it showed on Comedy Central like every day for 2 years.
Yeah. I got my Let's Be Cops. I got that one mixed up with Let's Be Cops or whatever the hell it was called. I like Jake Johnson. I think he's great. What was that movie with him and Olivia Wilde? Drinking Buddies. Shot right here in Chicago. That's a really good movie. Let's see. We got the 414 area code says, well, a classic, The Great Escape and The Dirty Dozen. Those are kind of like, you know, your quintessential prison movies right there. The Great Escape, legendary. All right, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We got some weather here, and then we'll jump back into the prison movies. And I think I'm going to sneeze. There we go. Okay. ¶¶ Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Right here, WGN. We're talking about prison movies. Let's see. Part of it here is, of course, The Bridge on the River Kwai. It might not be David Lean's finest film. Lawrence of Arabia surely tops that list, but Bridge on the River Kwai comes damn close. One of the earliest films to tackle the experience of soldiers in Japanese POW camps. It sees a group of mostly British soldiers interred in a camp in Burma where they're put to work on the construction of the railroad bridge, the railway bridge. Senior Officer Alec Guinness initially resisting before deciding to keep up the men's morale and show their captors the British spirit by complying, while an American soldier, played by William Holden, plots to destroy the completed structure. So it is it's a terrific movie. Classic. One of those big David Lean, big budget epics. But yeah, that's a classic one. Here's David on WGN. Hi, David.
Yeah, I was thinking of Brubaker with Robert Redford.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
Yeah. I was thinking about this one prison movie where Jimmy Stewart was building a rifle in a prison. I can't think of the name of that movie.
What was it again?
Jimmy Stewart was building a rifle in prison. He was a moonshiner, and he got arrested and sent to prison for shooting a guy, and then he was sent to prison. In prison, he was fixing and repairing rifles, and then he built one.
Okay, I can't think of the name of it either. But if somebody might know, if you want to jump in here, 312-981-7200. All right, David, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Bye.
As he mentions, Brubaker, the dramatization of real life events, Stuart Rosenberg's return to the prison genre after Cool Hand Luke, which he directed. It never reaches that touchpoint standards, but despite an overlong made-for-TV feel, it deserves a spot, at least for showing us the other side of the coin. Following Robert Redford's crusading reform warden, it's a harsh, unsparing, ultimately depressing look at the systemic corruption, deprivation, and brutality in a southern prison, and at how comprehensively the new warden's efforts to clean it up are blocked and paired by the higher-ups. Despite an early non-gravitas showcase from Morgan Freeman and a supporting turn from Yaphet Kotto, so good it threatens to become his film, Redford's Brubaker and too many of the other characters remain frustratingly out of reach as people as opposed to archetypes. I liked Brubaker. I thought Brubaker was a pretty strong movie. How about this one, Bronson? Nicholas Winding Refn's pop art nightmare biopic tells the truish story of money but Peterson loves the prison and yearns to be famous, taking on the name Charles Bronson and turning his many violent tendencies into art. As the title character, Tom Hardy gives a career-making performance that combines perfectly with Refn's thrilling direction, which sees him at his most full-tilt operatic. Violent, gorgeously photographed, hilarious, embroidered with animation and slow motion that borders on still photography. Plunging the viewer into the dark recesses of Bronson's maniacal mind, Hardy and Refn deliver a funny, scary, psychotic jolt, which yielded a surprisingly lukewarm critical reaction at the time. Tom Hardy's career, it launched Tom Hardy's career. Yeah, he's really terrific in that movie. I don't think it's quite as good a movie as this person who wrote the piece did. I like it. That was the movie that where you were like, when you saw Bronson, you were like, who is this guy? And then, of course, it turned out to be Tom Hardy, who is now one of my favorite actors. Hi, Nick. It's Kathy from Bolingbrook. Hi, Kathy. My favorite prison movies are The Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile. I also like The Rock for its scenes of Alcatraz, which I toured and loved. Love your show. Yeah, The Rock is a really goofy movie, but it's fun. It's fun. 301 area code says Unchained is a pretty obscure prison film, but it's where Unchained Melody originated. Oh, okay. 917 area code says another Nick Cage classic, Con Air, Prison on a Plane. Yeah, Con Air is another one of those pretty stupid movies that I actually kind of enjoy. despite the fact that it's a pretty stupid movie. But, you know, it's so completely over the top, and everybody, I mean, you know, there are so many, like, really fun actors seemingly having a great time in that movie. And, of course, you know, Nicolas Cage's mullet is pretty legendary. Robert Redford, another prison movie, made The Last Castle. Yeah. Nick, I believe this movie is called Half Past Dead with Steven Seagal and Ja Rule. I think that qualifies as a prison movie. It's from JB. I have to tell you, I didn't see Half Past Dead. I know I like to be a completist when it comes to my Steven Seagal movies, but I did not see Half Past Dead.
I watched Under Siege yesterday.
I like that movie.
I did a little Andy Davis double feature.
Mm-hmm.
Under Siege and The Fugitive.
You know the story of how I saw Under Siege.
Yeah, didn't you watch it with...
with Gary Busey.
With Gary Busey, and then you guys hung out for like a week.
We did. Gary Busey sat next to me during the screening of Under Siege and essentially did what, you know, is basically DVD commentary.
I'm still telling you, you need to write a book, My Week with Gary.
It's unbelievable.
I would read the heck out of it.
773 area code, George C. Scott movie, Paths of Glory. George C. Scott's not in Paths of Glory.
It's Kirk Douglas.
It's Kirk Douglas. It's not a prison movie. It's a war movie. Well,
I think it's because they're dealing with deserters.
Yeah, no, I guess that. Yeah, I guess it would qualify. I guess it would qualify. All right, let's see. Here is Scott on WGN. Hi, Scott.
Hey, good morning, Nick.
Morning.
One of my favorite soundtracks also, but the movie Midnight Express.
Yeah, that's a brutal movie. Brutal.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
It'll wipe you out.
Yep. Absolutely, man. That is a brutal film, one of Oliver Stone's first screenplays. Yeah. All right, Scott, thanks.
Hey, no problem.
Okay.
Have a good day.
See ya. Scott sounded like he was in a wind tunnel. You haven't seen Midnight Express. We've talked about this before, right?
No, I've not seen Midnight Express.
Got to see it. Alan Parker.
There's a lot of Alan Parker that I haven't.
Yeah, we have talked.
We've talked about how badly I need to.
You need to brush up on your Alan Parker. I mean,
I can't just keep watching The Commitments.
No, you should start. You should seriously start with Shoot the Moon.
Probably, yeah.
With Albert Finney and Diane Keaton. One of my favorite movies of all time.
See, this is one of those reasons that I miss the video store.
Yeah,
like I know, you can find it online, you can rent it there, but I would just be able to walk into a video store, grab all, you know, 10 DVDs to get started.
Yeah.
And no problem.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of Alan Parker that you need to...
There's a lot.
That you need to see. There's a lot more than The Commitments. And as much as I enjoy The Commitments, and I do enjoy The Commitments very much...
That's just a taster.
Yeah. And then 847 area code is, what about The Last Detail? That's one of... I love that movie so much. Not really a prison movie. They're taking the kid. They're taking Randy Quaid to prison.
Yeah,
but that's a good movie, man. Yeah.
Randy Quaid giving the performance of his entire career.
Wow, it's just such a sweetheart in that movie, and he's so.
Is.
I mean, and I'm blanking on the African American actor's name, which I feel terrible about. He only did one or two movies. He wasn't in a lot of movies. Nicholson is amazing in that movie, and then I love the Linkletter follow up from a couple of years ago.
Yeah, Otis Young.
Otis Young, fantastic.
Yeah. Awesome.
I mean, it is a great movie. Written by the great Robert Towne, directed by Hal Ashby. That's a quintessential great 70s movie. Okay. All right, we're going to break here. Everybody hang on. 312-981-7200. We're talking about prison movies, and we would love to hear from you. What are your favorites? And we'll do that right after the news, which is coming up after this.
I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried. Mama tried to raise me better. But her pleading I deny. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried.
That's right. Ah, yes. You know, that brings up, you know, we're talking about prison movies, but also I love the subgenre and music of the prison songs.
Oh, yeah.
They're fantastic. And of course, Johnny Cash is the king of that. But yeah, Mama tried. welcome back, everybody. It is the anniversary of the first federal prisoners to be dropped into Alcatraz. So we thought we'd talk about prison movies. It's a fun genre. There's a ton of them. And we've been remembering a few and And I've heard of a couple. I never heard of this movie, The Hill, with Sean Connery. And I want to thank that listener for calling in and telling me about it, because I really want to see. Is it available? Can you see if it's available on the DVD market? The Hill?
Yeah.
Who directed it?
Sidney Lumet.
Sidney Lumet directed it?
Yeah. Yeah. This is why it's stuck in my head, because I was like, my dad never shut up about this movie where Sean Connery kept going up this hill.
How do I not? I mean, Sidney Lumet, man. Holy cow. Well, that's got a must-see written all over it.
Yeah, you get on DVD for about $15.
Oh, there you go. Wow. Had no idea. How do I know? How is it possible that I didn't know that there was a Sidney Lumet movie called The Hill? How?
I don't know. I honestly can't believe it either.
It's just crazy.
A movie that you've never heard of.
It was directed by Sidney Lumet. Wow, man. All right. It was fun talking with Lance Henderson about him working with Sidney Lumet.
Oh, that was one of the funniest parts of that interview. And also when he was talking about working with John Cazale.
Yeah.
And
they were laughing before he shot him in the forehead in Dog Day Afternoon, because Lance kills John Cazale in Dog Day.
Great stuff.
Yeah, he's amazing. Very cool dude. I have a very, very memorable picture of me and Lance from this year's flashback where he's flipping everybody the bird. Got a cigarette in his mouth, flipping the bird. Lance Hendricks. Only Lance Hendricks can get away with that.
I'm really glad I got to witness it.
You did. You took the picture.
Yeah. Yeah.
So here's Ken on WGN. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Nick. The name of that movie with Jimmy Stewart is Carbine Williams. He developed a rifle for the U.S. Army.
That's it. That's the one.
That's a true story.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the one.
And also this classic one, Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS with Diane Thorne.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm very familiar with the Ilsa movies. I got to tell you, Ken. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
oh, my God. That was when I first saw that movie.
Yeah.
Oh, did you guys mention Starlock 17 yet?
No, we haven't mentioned that.
Huh? Yeah, you won the Academy Award for that.
Yeah. That's absolutely a classic.
Oh, yeah.
Classic,
yeah,
Starlock 17.
There's one called the Gulag. I forget who was in that one. The Gulag.
Right.
He escapes to Russia, to Finland.
Right.
Yeah. There's a bunch of them. Yeah. Ilsa, she made a couple of them.
Yeah, she did. I know. I'm familiar with those movies. All right, Ken, thanks.
Oh, my God.
Thanks,
welcome,
buddy.
Bye.
Take care, Carbine Williams. That's the name of the Jimmy Stewart movie.
You know, at Flashback, there was like I love Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS. I think it's just so bonkers. But there was like a shirt or something, and I came this close, and I was like, actually, you know what? I feel like a lot of people are not going to get this if I wear it in public.
Yeah.
Probably not the best idea.
Yeah.
But it's a very special
It's got a huge cult following, those movies. Huge.
Nazi-sploitation.
Yeah. You know what's really funny? Yesterday marked the 28th anniversary of the debut of Ren and Stimpy.
That it did, yeah.
Which, of course, is one of the greatest things that's ever happened to the world, is Ren and Stimpy. And oddly enough, their first short was called Big House Blues. And that's when they're thrown when they're thrown into the hooscow at the beginning. So there's another little tie-in right there. So have I ever told you the story of the first time I saw Ren and Stimpy?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so.
Here's the thing. Ren and Stimpy debuted on Nickelodeon, like I said, in August of 91. In December of 1990, I was at a press screening of an animated film festival that would be playing at Music Box. And so they screened it for us, and it's just a bunch of shorts. So it was one of those deals where, like, a lot of these animation festivals that would come to town, it would be a mixed bag. Sometimes you got great stuff, sometimes not so great. And this was not a particularly great one. This was in December of 1990. So it was me, my buddy Sergio Mims, and I'm sitting next to Dave Kerr, who is my favorite film critic. And this was back in 1990. And it has not been a great, like, we've, you know, because I'm a huge, I love animation, and I love the animation festivals and all that cool stuff. And there, you know, of all of the shorts, I think there were two or three that kind of stood out. The rest of them were kind of ho-hum. The final short that they showed, the very last short that they showed, was Big House Blues. And I had never seen anything like it. I had never seen anything like it. And I lost my mind. Me and Dave Kerr and Sergio, we were doubled over with laughter at the very, you know, at the very first Ren and Stimpy. And I just, I, you know, for those of you who have, who ended up, and Ren and Stimpy obviously became very popular and on both Nickelodeon and then on MTV. And John Kritzvalusi, became a very well-known artist and cartoonist. And he's nuts. John Kay is nuts. And so just the attention to detail, the imagery, the ridiculousness of the characters, the voice work, everything about Ren and Stimpy just stood out to me like I've never seen anything like this. This is one of the greatest animated things I've ever seen in my life. And I lost my mind. Like, I could not stop laughing. I was crying. I had tears rolling down my face. I honestly couldn't believe what I was watching. Like, woo, what kind of a lunatic would make this? So we had a press release with it. They gave us, you know, like a press release with, you know, the credits for each of the shorts. And this one said that Ren and Stimpy will be airing on Nickelodeon. So this was December of 1990. And I'm not making this up. I'm not making this up. Every week I'd get the TV guide and I would scour Nickelodeon, and it didn't come on until August of 91. So it was almost a year later that I had to wait and scour through. And then when it came on, it was the, like, I mean, I don't even know. You know, the funniest, one of the funniest cartoon I've ever seen in my life. And I'm including Looney Tunes, which are obviously brilliant and hilarious. And I'm including Tex Avery, Chuck Jones, all those guys who are heroes in the animated world, in the cartoon world. The funniest animated short I've ever seen in my life, the hardest I've ever laughed at anything, and I watched it, I've seen it a million times, is Sven Hoke. When Ren's idiot cousin shows up and bonds with Stimpy, and then Ren comes home from work with the briefcase and the little suit jacket, the tie and the hat, and sees that the entire house is a mess. They violated his dinosaur eggs, and so he, like, basically corners them and is, I'm so angry. Yeah. I mean, this is genius. And visually.
What I'm gonna do to you. I'm so angry. First, I'm going to tear your lips out. Yeah. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. And it goes on. But seriously, that's the funniest cartoon I've ever seen. It's the funniest cartoon I've ever seen. And it's weird, too, because it's like almost, it goes into a really scary sort of almost abusive parent territory at the end.
It's psychotic.
Oh, it's nuts.
It's crazy.
John Kay is crazy. I had him on my show a couple times. He's nuts. He's nuts. Mm-hmm. And then some of because obviously he had to fight with Nickelodeon, which is one of the reasons why, you know, he was fired. And then, like, you know, some other people came in and took over creatively. And you could see there was a drop in quality. And I've had Billy West on the show, a bunch of times.
I mean, Billy West is a legend.
He's a complete legend. Absolute legend. He ended up taking over. He did Ren after they fired John Kay. When they fired John, because John Kay did the voice of Ren. I'm going to hit you. And you're going to fall down.
I just can't get over Log.
Log is the best, man. Powdered Toast Man? Come on.
Powdered Toast Man. What was the name? What was the deal with the horse again?
Mr. Horse.
Yeah, Mr. Horse was great.
Don't like it at all. Someone call the police. Do you have any rubber walrus protectors? Call the police. But, yeah, that debuted 28 years ago yesterday, and their first episode was a prison episode. So there you go. Ties in. Everything ties in. All right, we got more here to talk about, more prison movies if you want to jump in.
Someone call the doctor. Tell him that I'm sick. See, my woman left me, and he better come real quick. I got a broken heart for certain. The
right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we are here till 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. Yeah! And that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. That's coming up. We've been talking about prison movies. This is the anniversary. 1934 was the first time that federal prisoners were actually dropped into Alcatraz. So we've been talking about that and then getting into the prison movies. And Mike from Novak Construction says, hello, Nick. How about when the Three Stooges were in prison, painting guard uniforms over their prison uniforms to escape? Yeah, there are a few Stooges shorts where they're in prison. Yeah, and they try to escape. There have been a few of those. Dan says, Dead Man Walking. Yeah, that was a good movie. That's a really good movie.
Is that Sean Penn?
Sean Penn was in it. Yeah. Tim Robbins directed it.
Yeah.
Susan Sarandon won the Oscar for it. The thing about it was because, you know, the politics of Tim Robbins, he's so far left that I thought the movie was just going to be really preachy. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
way against the death sentence. But it's not at all. It's really even. It's really evenly balanced. You know what I mean? And I just didn't expect that. And also, everybody in it is great.
Absolutely.
It's the first time I remember seeing Jack Black. No, the first time I remember seeing Jack Black was in another Tim Robbins movie, which was very heavy-handed, but a movie I loved, Bob Roberts.
Bob Roberts.
Bob Roberts is a great fake documentary about this incredibly right-wing guy running for office, but he also sings songs that are like incredibly politically incorrect, and Tim Robbins wouldn't really... Everybody wanted him to release those songs. And he wouldn't do it because the messages of the songs were just so not in his wheelhouse as it politically. But that was the first time I remember seeing Jack Black. He's in it for about 2 minutes, but he plays like a psychotic fan of Bob Roberts. and that's the first time I remember seeing Jack Black. I was like, that guy's funny. 772 area code says secret admirer. What? It is so a prison movie. I have been imprisoned by the love of Kelly Preston ever since. Sorry, but it's on right now. Secret Admirer, not a prison movie. A ridiculous movie, but not a prison movie. David said White Heat. Sure. James Cagney.
Isn't Steve Cochran in White Heat?
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
Yeah, Steve Cochran, who was...
And he does die in White Heat.
Our intrepid morning host... was named after this kind of obscure character actor from the 40s and 50s that Steve's mom was in love with. So that's how he was named. He was actually named after that guy. That was really funny when Dean says, I looked it up and you're dead. And apparently he was a big drinker and a big womanizer.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, apparently the whole shtick was that Steve Cochran, the character actor, died in all of his movies. Like, he consistently died these kind of ridiculous deaths.
Right. Right. Yeah, he was killed in all of his movies. And that's who Steve, our good old Steve Cochran here on the mornings, that's who he was named after. So. Okay, so how is it possible that we're talking about prison movies, and Escape from New York has not come up till now? How is it possible?
That's a good question.
we've been talking about this for a while, and the Escape from New York just comes up now. And Escape from L.A.
We can't forget Escape from L.A.
Can't forget Escape from L.A.
Especially him surfing.
Yeah. And then the Jaws shark. The basketball scene. It's fantastic.
I really have a non-ironic love for Escape from L.A.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
There's no kidding. I love Escape from L.A. Boy, did that thing tank.
Oh, yeah, no.
Man. And people don't like that movie at all.
Yeah.
I like it. I think it's great. I mean, the original Escape from New York is, I mean, you know.
Significantly better, but.
Legendary. But here's what they wrote. This one already made our Essential John Carpenter Films list back in 2013. Essential John Carpenter films, all of them.
you're really going to have to sit me down and convince me for Ghosts of Mars, but...
Oh, I love Ghosts of Mars. I love that movie.
That might have to be for a different time.
No, I love Ghost of Mars, man. That's like the 20th time he made Rio Bravo. He's made Rio Bravo like 7-8 times. No, I love Ghost of Mars. It came at the right time in the director's prime when it seemed he could do no wrong. It's a total blast, featuring the first of many team-ups with Kurt Russell doing his best John Wayne impression here and taking the prison movie to a new, occasionally silly but always fun sci-fi height. The concept of a future dystopian New York City that's now a full-on maximum security prison for the country's nastiest goons is brilliant and ripe for social commentary, but even more impressive is Carpenter's resourcefulness. Like all his films from that era, it just feels significantly bigger in scope than the limited budget and production scale might suggest. Oh, and Snake Plissken is just so cool, with that roguish bad boy swagger mixed with proud anti-heroism and some wonderfully cheesy one-liners. Now that there's a Carpenter renaissance happening, his trademark synthy scores and widescreen genre filmmaking on a dime approach have been all the rage in the U.S. indie films now, and there's no better time to catch up on your Carpenter and see what this new generation is ripping off, and this is a great place to start. Escape from New York is just a classic. I remember the first time I saw it. I saw it July. It was July 4th, 1981. And we saw it. My parents and I went, and we saw it at the, what was it? The Hillside Theaters. Not the Hillside Theater, but there was a group of theaters, but I think it was like six screens. Hillside Square. That was the theater. And it was a sneak preview because it opened the following week. So it was a one night only sneak preview, 4th of July, of Escape from New York. And I lost my mind.
I forgot. What's the percentage that crime goes up?
It goes up
like 400%.
400%. In 1997.
Yeah.
That's when the crime. No, the crime rate rises in 1991.
Okay. That's when it goes up 400%.
400% in 1991. Yeah. The prison, that's when I don't think they specify what year New York is turned into when Manhattan is turned into a prison.
It's just subsequent.
But the movie takes place in 1997.
Yeah. The hellscape that is 1997.
Yeah. Oh, it's such a good movie. It's so good. I mean, at that point, you know, he had done Dark Star, Assault on Precinct 13, Halloween, The Fog, and then Escape from New York. I mean, the run that guy was on, man.
It's unbelievable.
It's ridiculous. You follow that one up with The Thing. Not bad. Then Christine, which is terrific.
Yeah.
Starman. Big Trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went back to his indie roots.
They Live.
For They Live and Prince of Darkness, which are two of his best movies.
Oh, yeah.
Because he had such a terrible time with Big Trouble.
Oh, I imagine. I mean, was that a Universal picture?
20th Century Fox.
Oh, so, ooh.
Yeah.
Mm.
No, but it's, you know, The Thing almost, that was Universal.
Yeah, that was definitely.
The Thing almost ended his career, too.
Yeah. Now Universal gets to reap all the benefits.
Well, see, that's the thing. You know, I mean, there's movies like that, like a lot of Carpenter's movies from the past, and I've mentioned this 9,000 times. You know, like, when The Thing came out, it tanked. I think it bombed. So did Big Trouble in Little China. And now they're both considered, like, ultimate 80s classics, and they are. They're great movies. It's just that when they came out, nobody went to see them. But you know, you'd be hard pressed to find somebody who doesn't think The Thing is one of the greatest science fiction movies ever made.
Yeah,
science fiction horror movies ever made.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
And Big Trouble in Little China, one of the most entertaining adventure satires ever. And Jack Burton, one of the greatest characters ever. Yeah, but he's the man. Carpenter's the man. So Escape from New York, obviously, if you're talking about prison movies, you'd be remiss if you don't mention that one, and I'll back Escape from LA too. So, all right, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're going to jump in for the news, and then after the news, we'll talk more about this. Wrap up the prison movie talk. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke, and we want to hear from you. Phone lines and text lines are open. 312-981-7200. News next.
An icy wind burns and scars, rushes in like a fallen star through the narrow space between these bars, looking down on prison grow.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And, yeah, we're back. And we've been talking about prison movies because this was the anniversary. Yesterday was the anniversary of the first federal prisoners to be dropped into Alcatraz, which is probably the most infamous prison ever. And so we were talking about prison movies. There have been a ton of them. We still have a lot more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Also, just a few minutes, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. So if you want to jump in here with your prison movies, we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. Here's Mike from Berwyn on WGN. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Nick. How you doing? Great right. show.
Thank you.
How about The Longest Yard?
Oh,
either one.
Legendary. Classic.
Right, right.
Yeah. No, that's a great, it's a, not only a great prison movie, but it's a great football movie.
Right, right. Very, very funny, too, some of those scenes in there.
Oh, yeah. I love that movie. Yeah. Okay, Mike, thanks. Yeah.
All right, thanks, Nick.
All right, take care. Yeah, The Longest Yard, not the remake with Adam Sandler. No. But the original is fantastic. Directed by Robert Aldrich. I love that movie. I showed it last year at my film club. And Esmeralda came. She was never, you know, like a big, she was never a big, you know, Burt Reynolds fan. She would just, she thought, you know, like the only thing that she thought Burt Reynolds was always, you know, and doing the Smokey and the Bandit all the goofy crap. But, you know, like he did some movies that, well, I turned you onto one of them.
Oh my God. Sharky's Machine.
Legendary.
So good.
It's a great movie. Directed that one too. But like, Esmeralda came, Esmeralda, our good friend Esmeralda Leon. We got to get her back in studio again.
Oh, yeah, she, next Friday.
Next Friday?
Yeah.
All right, cool. So she came to see it at my film club and was like, wow, that was really good. Like, she was surprised, you know, because it was like Burt Reynolds just, you know, being cool and tough and not being, you know, like goofy car-driving goofball. You know, like it, he's made some terrible movies. Stroker Ace is one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life.
Is it bad that I still get a kick out of it?
Oh, God, I can't
stand
that
movie. I'm still like, if Stroker Ace came on TV, I'd be like, I'm going to watch Stroker Ace.
Can't do it. I'll tell you which one I love, though. And I love the first Smokey and the Bandit. The first Smokey and the Bandit.
You can't not
love it. Is great, and everything about it, it also is just of that time. You know what
totally.
I mean? Like, it, you know, that's a 1977 movie.
Well, especially at a time when you could still bootleg.
Yeah. Coors.
Coors.
You bring your Coors across the county line, across the state line. But, you know, a lot of the reason why that movie is so great is Jackie Gleason. Jackie Gleason is unbelievable in it. Unbelievable. The sequel's not so much. Second one was so stupid. They were had a pregnant elephant that they were hauling across the country, and Dom DeLuise played an Italian doctor who had to treat the elephant while he got drunk on wine. It was a terrible movie. By that point, Sally Field was obligated to do it, even though she'd won an Oscar for Norma Rae.
Yeah.
Like, her career had taken, and they had broken up, too, at that point.
Oh, yeah.
They were broken up, but she was like, all right, I'll do you a favor, and I'll come back, you know, to do the movie. And you could just tell, like, every line reading is just like, oh, my God, what am I doing this for? Yeah. I have an Oscar. I won an Oscar.
And then there's Smokey 3, which is just...
Smokey and the Bandit 3, Smokey is the Bandit.
Smokey is the Bandit.
And not even Burt Reynolds is in that.
Yeah.
It was so bad that Burt Reynolds didn't do it, and Burt Reynolds was in Stroker Ace. He's got a cameo in it.
Yeah.
But Jerry Reed plays... he's pretending to be the Bandit.
Wow.
Jackie Gleason plays four roles in it?
So he's Buford T. Justice.
And his brothers.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it's just, it's unwatchable.
That's depressing.
But I'll tell you what movie I really like. And this was a movie that also inspired Tarantino. This was a movie, Burt Reynolds inspired the Brad Pitt character.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, Burt Reynolds, because Burt Reynolds was supposed to play the part that Bruce Dern plays.
Yeah, George Spawn.
And he passed.
Yeah.
But Burt Reynolds wrote a line of dialogue. Quentin Tarantino's telling everybody he wrote a line of dialogue in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's the line of dialogue when he's having the confrontation with Bruce Lee, and Bruce Lee says, "You're very pretty for a stunt man." That was Burt Reynolds. He said, "You gotta have him say you're really pretty for a stunt man."
Yeah.
So that's Burt Reynolds wrote that line. that the Bruce Lee character says in the movie.
Yeah.
But anyway, the movie that one of the movies that inspired you know, a lot of the ideas was this movie called Hooper. Have you ever seen Hooper?
Yeah, I've definitely seen it.
It's a terrific movie. And it's a Jan Michael Vincent plays the young upstart guy who comes in, and Hal Needham directed it. Who started out as a stuntman? Started out as Burt Reynolds' stuntman.
Yeah,
very much like the relationship that DiCaprio and Brad Pitt had in the movie. Yeah. That was all taken pretty much from Hal Needham and Burt Reynolds.
I love that.
Yeah, and it's such a great movie.
It just is.
It's great. All right, we're prison movies. Here we go. 773 area code says American Me and Blood In, Blood Out. Both huge in the Latin community. Yes. American Me is a great film. Blood In, Blood Out, if I remember correctly, it had a different name. It went by Blood In, Blood Out in a different title. And if I remember correctly, it was Taylor Hackford directed that. And they're both good. Like Blood In, Blood Out and American Me. American Me is really good. And I'm trying to remember what Blood In, Blood Out's
other. It was also known as Bound by Honor.
That's it, Bound by Honor. And it was directed by Taylor Hackford, right?
Correct.
Okay. American Me was directed by Edward James Olmos.
Yeah.
And he's in it, too. It's a great movie.
Is that, oh my God, now I can't remember his name. It'll come to me. I'm trying to think of some of the other people that are in American Me.
It's a huge cast.
It's a massive cast. Yeah. Danny Trejo.
Yeah, Danny Trejo's in that. It's an epic, too. It's a really long movie. It's almost 3 hours.
Yeah.
And they came out very close to, in time to one another.
Yeah, within a year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. William Forsythe.
No, it's a ridiculous cast.
Oh my God.
Yeah. 772 area code says Andersonville, the true story of the Civil War prison in the South, where the Northern prisoners are pitted against each other in a fight for survival, and why the North was so driven to punish the South for its mistreatment of prisoners. Andersonville, good movie. Also, great neighborhood that I used to live in.
Mm-hmm. It's still a great neighborhood.
312 area code says, how about Lockup with Sly and Sutherland? Yeah, Sylvester Stallone, and the warden was played by Donald Sutherland. Here's the thing about Lockup. Lockup is ridiculous. It's a ridiculous movie.
As one might expect.
But there's an unbelievable football sequence in that movie. Like a brutal, fantastic football sequence right in the middle of Lockup. Yeah. And I see that you always have to have, like, you always have to have the, you know, the evil warden. That's always like when you make the good guys, when you make the prisoners the good guys in movies, you always have to have, like, an evil warden. So Donald Sutherland was the evil warden in Lockup. I can't remember the actor's name in Shawshank. Who was the actor who played the warden in Shawshank? Why am I blanking on his name? I can picture him, but I can't remember his name. But he played, you know, of course, he was the evil warden in Shawshank. Patrick McGowan was the evil warden in Escape from Alcatraz. He was the evil warden with Clint Eastwood as your hero.
Bob Gunton.
Bob Gunton, right, exactly. Okay. Here's one that is an unusual. I mean, it's an interesting choice, but it's an unusual one. It is a prison movie for sure, and that's Kiss of the Spider Woman. Despite picking up 4 Oscar nominations, being the first independent film nominated for Best Picture, and winning the Best Actor statue for William Hurt, Hector Babenko's Kiss of the Spider Woman has somewhat fallen off the radar in the years since, and that's unfortunate because despite uneven elements, particularly the sections reimagining old film noir, it's still a remarkable film that's precisely germane to the topic of incarceration, while also providing heady provocative arguments on the value of escapism, especially storytelling and escapist Hollywood filmmaking in particular. Louis and Valentine, played by Raul Julia, are cellmates in a South American prison. Louis is flamboyant but frightened, a gay man imprisoned for sex with an underage boy, and Valentine is jailed for his radical politics and pines for the woman he loved but could never have. As the film unfolds, it suggests that movies, politics, and love are all connecting us to one another in a meaningful, transcendent ways. But at its most striking moral is one that predates the Shawshank Redemption. It is no matter how small the cell, friendship, even forged in the unlikely places, can be its own kind of liberation. Yeah, it's a really good movie, Kiss of the Spider-Woman. Really good. And then it became a Broadway musical. It turned into a Broadway musical, if I'm not mistaken. Like in the late 80s, early 90s, Kiss of the Spider-Woman became a Broadway musical. And I think people really enjoyed it, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. Okay, guys, hang on a second, okay? Hang on. Everybody hang on. We got to take a break. We got the weather coming up here, and then my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We'll hear my dad's joke, which is always a fun thing, here on a Monday morning, and then we'll jump back into the conversation, wrap up the show, and wrap up the conversation about prison movies. 312-981-7200.
It's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go. With your music intro.
Ah! It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Yeah! What'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go!
Ah, that's right. All right, everybody. Hey, how you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning, here till 5 a.m., coming up at 5. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell, and also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, you heard that theme. You know what that means. My dad has been telling jokes his whole life, and we have him call in every Monday morning to tell a joke. And we're having that right now. So there you go. Let's get my dad on the air. Hey, Dad.
Hi, Nick.
How are you, buddy?
Doing great.
Good. How's Ma?
Good.
All right. You got a joke?
Got a joke.
All right.
Guy said, my wife hates it when our next door neighbor sunbathes topless in her yard. Personally, I'm on the fence.
All right. All right. All right.
You tell you, Dad, you really got Tom on that one. He is laughing. He's laughing his head off right there, man. There you go. Personally, I'm on the fence. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, Dad. Thanks, buddy.
Take care.
See you later. There you go. All right.
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
That's it. He'll do it again next week.
Had to wait 2 weeks for my fix.
Oh, yeah. We were off last week because of flashback, so my dad did not get to tell his joke. But he'll do it again next week, so we're all set there. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, and we're going to wrap up the conversation here that we've been having this morning. It is the anniversary. 1934 was the first time that federal prisoners were actually put into Alcatraz. So in honor of that, we are talking about prison movies. 312-981-7200. Here's Ven on WGNI, Ven.
Good morning to all of y'all.
Morning.
Penitentiary One with Leon Isaac Kennedy.
Yeah, classic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, that, indeed.
It's a brutal movie, too. Really, really brutal. But the sequels were terrible, though. Oh, man.
Oh, really? Awful.
Awful. But the first one was great. Not only Penitentiary is not only a good prison movie, it's also a good boxing movie.
So, yes.
Yeah, really good stuff. It's a classic. All right, Ven, thanks, man.
All right, bro.
Yeah, I remember when Penitentiary came out. Very low budget movie that got a big boost from Siskel and Ebert, like a really big boost. And then the sequel came out, which is one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life, Penitentiary 2. And it was one of those rushed sequels. Like it came out, I think I want to say 6-7 months after the original Penitentiary. That was back when Leon Isaac Kennedy was married to Jane Kennedy.
Uh-huh.
And they did like a Playboy spread. Like when that
the
movie.
Two of them?
Yeah.
That is, that's a first for me.
Yeah. I remember it was, and she was on CBS Sports. She was like a big host on CBS Sports and, beautiful woman, Jane Kennedy. Beautiful.
You know, I know about this movie. I have never seen it.
Oh, it's good.
Yeah. It's,
one of those, it's really one of those, a great independent movie from a time when independent movies weren't hip.
Yeah.
Like, it cost nothing to make. Like, this was done on a shoestring. And it had barely a release. I mean, it got released, but it was not like a national... It went city to city. It's a great example of early 80s independent filmmaking.
Right.
And it's really edgy. and really violent and really intense. But very much worth seeing, without question. Here's Rick on WGN. Hi, Rick.
Hey, Nick. Good waking up with you every morning.
Thank you.
That's one of the best prison movies ever. Sylvester Stallone and Pele in Victory.
Oh, sure. And Michael Caine. Yeah.
Yep. And did you know that was loosely based on a true story, too?
I did not know it was based on a true story.
It was the Germans playing the Russians in World War II in a soccer game, POWs versus the prison guards.
Yeah.
The story is, and this is just what I heard, the Russians beat the Germans 10-0, and the next day the Russians were no longer with us.
Ah, wow. Okay. So, all right. Okay. Yeah. All right, Rick.
Thank you.
All right. You ever see Victory?
Yeah, I've seen Victory. It was good.
The thing about that movie is that they spend, like, all this time planning this prison break, and that's going to happen during the game, that they, you know, they do all this planning. And I remember, I can't remember which character, one of the characters has to break his arm.
Yeah.
So they put his arm, I remember they put his arm like on the bunk bed, and then and there's between like a gap, his forearm, and then they like smash his arm and break his arm, because I can't remember why, but he has to go to the infirmary or something. So here's the thing about that movie, is that they're going to get away. They got like a clean escape. They're going to make it, and they go, let's go back.
Yeah,
they go back because they want to win the game.
Yeah, it's really ridiculous. my favorite prison soccer movie, which is a surprising subgenre, is just a remake of The Longest Yard called Mean Machine.
Mean Machine, yeah,
with Vinny Jones, yeah. The most dangerous man in football.
Yeah,
love it.
Yeah, Mean Machine. Yeah, classic. Yeah, that's a great movie. And the Victory. I remember going, come on, man,
you don't go back.
You're gonna go back just so you can win a soccer game. So, here's Barbara on WGN. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I don't know if you recall this movie. I took a course in high school back in the 70s. It's called Film Studies. And we saw the movie, It's a Glass House.
Oh, The Glass House, sure. Yeah.
Oh, you do recall that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And who was in that? Anybody big or no?
No, I can't remember. I do not remember. I remember seeing it. I don't remember who's in it. Tom?
It was a very good movie.
I'm trying to see. I mean, there's The Glass House, a fairly popular, so it's a prison. I want to say this is the one, I hope it is. It's got Vic Morrow, Alan Alda.
That's it. That's the one.
Yep.
Yeah, Billy Dee, directed by Tracy Keenan Wynn, and the story is by Truman Capote and Wyatt Cooper.
That's it. That's the one.
Oh.
All right, Barbara, thank you.
Thank you. All have a good week.
Okay. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. How about this? Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, with David Bowie from 1983. I remember when that came out. It's a very strange movie, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. But Bowie was not known for making normal movies. Like, when Bowie appeared in movies, they were usually weird. You know? Like Labyrinth.
Man Who Fell to Earth.
Man Who Fell to Earth, really weird. The Hunger, weird. We mentioned Midnight Express, Billy Hayes, based on the true story of Billy Hayes. Very, really, really hard movie to sit through. It's a very, very tough film. We mentioned Papillon earlier. And Rescue Dawn with Christian Bale. This came out of nowhere. I remember when this movie came out.
It was like 07?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a Werner Herzog movie, which means it's nuts. But Steve Zahn is really great in it, and I remember when it came out, nobody saw it. Like, it tanked at the box office. And it was like the year before he did The Dark Knight. So, like, I mean, his star was on the rise, but it wasn't quite like after The Dark Knight, you know, obviously. Bale was huge. Stalag 17 from 1953. They mentioned some other ones that are memorable. You've got The Rock that they mentioned. They mentioned Scum. They mentioned Caged Heat, the women's prison movie Jonathan Demme directed. the Green Mile. And, you know, you talk about Starlink 17. You can't talk about Starlink 17 and then not mention Chicken Run, which is one of my favorite animated movies. I love Chicken Run.
Yeah.
And that's a great, that's a great prison movie.
I don't want to be a pie.
It's just, it's so funny. And those guys.
Oh, yeah.
Wallace and Gromit. I mean, those, that animated company, Aardmore, they are amazing. And their last movie, nobody saw it.
What was their last one?
It was the one with the Bigfoot.
Oh, was it Smallfoot?
No. It had the Bigfoot in it, and it was a Hugh Jackman. Hugh Jackman was the voice of the guy who worked with them. They wanted to get him to home to his relatives. Missing Link. Missing Link.
Missing Link.
Yeah, and it was Zach Galifianakis who was the voice of the Missing Link. It was a great movie that five people saw. They did Coraline. They did Paranorman.
Oh, I thought that was
Studio
Leica.
Yeah, it is Leica.
Yeah.
Yeah. But those guys don't do the Chicken Run movies. Those are different. But those guys, it's the same kind of technique, though.
Right, yeah. No, totally.
So, all right. We have to break here. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich and the opening bell. And tomorrow on the show, we have She's Crafty, the all-female Beastie Boys tribute band. What? Okay. The all-female Beastie Boys tribute band, She's Crafty, will be here. And we'll also have Two for Tuesday and more.